Past, present and future of British political history.
There are always going to be sources of discussion, debate and disagreement.
Materials of State begins tomorrow afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 23rd of November. This is Jane Steele. Good morning. Delegations from Ukraine and the US, as well as European security chiefs, will meet in Geneva later today to discuss President Trump's controversial 28-point plan to end the war with Russia. The proposals would see Kyiv hand territory to Moscow and place limits on the size of Ukraine's armed forces. The US president had set President Zelensky a deadline of Thursday to accept the draft deal, but has now appeared to suggest there's room for manoeuvre. Here's our World News correspondent Joe Inwood.
As he boarded his helicopter at the White House, President Trump was asked, "Is this your final offer to Ukraine?" His answer, "No, not right now," will have given a glimmer of hope to Ukraine and its supporters, and suggested that today's talks could bear fruit. As well as top Ukrainian and US officials, European national security advisers will be taking part, hoping to get rid of any territorial concessions or limits on Ukraine's armed forces. In a joint statement yesterday, the leaders of the UK, EU, Japan and Canada said the 28-point plan required additional work. In diplomatic terms, a stinging criticism.
The COP30 UN climate summit in Brazil has closed. A final deal came hours after the official deadline and was judged by many to be nowhere near ambitious enough. There was a promise of more funding to help poorer nations, but no explicit mention of the fossil fuels that drive global warming. Some train fares in England are to be frozen next year for the first time in decades as part of broader government plans to transfer rail services back into public ownership. The freeze until March 2027 will apply to regulated fares, which include season tickets and off-peak returns. The Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, said the decision meant commuters would be able to keep more of their hard-earned cash.
If you're spending thousands of pounds on a season ticket to commute to work, actually it makes a really big difference not to see your fares going up by hundreds of pounds. And so they are significant savings for people. We think that's the right thing to do to help people with the cost of living. And I think it's a big moment given that rail fares haven't been frozen for the last 30 years.
The Chancellor is expected to use her upcoming budget to announce more than £1 billion in funding for a scheme encouraging the use of electric cars. The Electric Car Grant Scheme, which provides a discount of nearly £4,000 on eligible vehicles, will also be extended by an extra year. Here's our political correspondent, Georgia Roberts.
This scheme started in July as part of the move towards zero-emission vehicles. The government claims it's helped 35,000 switch to electric vehicles. Some early research, however, suggests there's little indication the scheme has attracted entirely new buyers. There'll also be money to create more charging points and a consultation on helping people without driveways to charge their cars. The cost of public electric vehicle charging, which has risen in recent years, will also be looked at. However, it's also possible that electric car owners could face a new tax elsewhere in the budget, potentially in the form of a paper mile charge from 2028. And the Chancellor's being urged not to raise taxes on drivers overall.
A House of Lords committee is warning that autistic people in England still face unacceptable inequalities, which are holding them back from leading fulfilling lives. The peers are urging the government to deliver real and lasting change. The Department of Health said ministers were committed to ensuring autistic people received high-quality, empathetic and dignified care. A gold pocket watch recovered from a passenger who drowned during the sinking of the Titanic has sold for almost £1.8 million. Auctioneers in Wiltshire believe it's the highest price ever paid for memorabilia linked to the ship. More details from Lucy Atchison.
The 18-carat gold pocket watch was owned by Isidore Strauss, one of the only first-class passengers who died when the Titanic sank in 1912. He'd been offered a place in a lifeboat but refused to leave while other men remained aboard. His wife Ida chose to stay with him. Mr. and Mrs. Strauss were last seen sitting together on deck chairs, a moment later depicted in James Cameron's 1997 blockbuster as the couple holding each other while the ship went down. The watch, recovered from Mr. Strauss's body and kept by his family, family for more than a century has now sold for £1,780,000, with auctioneers calling the record price a testament to the couple's ultimate love story.
Formula One, Red Bull's Max Verstappen has won the Las Vegas Grand Prix. The British McLaren driver Lando Norris came second, picking up valuable points to extend his lead in the Drivers' Championship. Britain's George Russell, who drives for Mercedes, came third. BBC News.
Many thanks, Jane Steele. This is BBC Radio 4. Coming up shortly, we've Heart and Soul. Then in half an hour, this week's On Your Farm visits the prison farm, which supplies food for inmates and helps teach them skills they can use to find work when they leave jail. The Supreme Court ruled on Wednesday that Northern Ireland's Christian-focused RE curriculum is unlawful. Since then, churches, politicians and schools there have been trying to make sense of the possible implications of that ruling, both for RE teaching and the place of religion in schools more generally. You can hear more on that discussion on Sunday, coming up at 7:10. That's all ahead here on BBC Radio 4.
BBC Scam Safe Week on Radio 4.
Helping you stay informed in the fight against fraud.
I'm Alfie Moore, cop-turned-comedian, and I'll be diving into a world of swindlers in a special edition of It's a Fair Cop.
Scam Secrets asks, how do you get your money back if you've been a victim of fraud? And You and Yours discovers the latest technology which criminals could use to scam you right under your nose. BBC Scam Safe Week, across this week
on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Time now for Heart and Soul. Maura Morrison meets Mara on Anglesey, who has found peace and belonging through Druidry.
Cyfarchaf i ti o braint, diwies yr afon hon sy'n llifo trwy yr tirlun sanctaidd yma. We call to you, O Braint, goddess of this sacred river that flows through...
The wind picked up there.
Which wind?
I'm Maura Morrison, and for this week's Heart and Soul, I've come to Anglesey in Wales. I'm here to meet local witch and druid Mara and learn why she and others around the UK are increasingly drawn to the nature-based religion of Druidry. And I'm curious about what it can teach us about connection and community.
One, two, one, two. Okay, I'm sat in the car outside of Bangor train station with Mara Starling. Mara, thank you so much for spending time with me.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to take you on a little bit of a magical tour.
Amazing. So we are going to head to the Isle of Anglesey. Where are you going to take us first? Tell us about our first stop.
Well, the first stop is on our way to the second stop, strangely enough, but it's the banks of yr Afon Braint, the River Braint on Anglesey. This river in particular is rather sacred to me and to many of my fellow druids and witches who live on the island. It's a river that flows pretty much throughout the entirety of the southwestern part of the island, and she is very much a goddess within our tradition, so I want to introduce you to her and to her waters as well.
Amazing. Let's go.
Just for the listeners, we're currently stood on a small bridge above a small river surrounded by hedges, fields, there's dog walkers behind us, and it is a little bit windy. So we're just standing looking down at the water.
So as a druid, the natural world presents to me all of the wisdom of life. We very much are natural beings ourselves, but because of the modern world we live in, with our technology, with our advancements, with our lovely air-conditioned and heated homes, we always feel kind of separate. And one thing that Druidry kind of teaches us is that we're not separate. So to me, Druidry is about living in accordance with the wisdom of the oak, the wisdom of the trees in general. And the trees remind us that no tree ever exists as a singularity, as a unique individual. A tree is constantly connected to all the other trees, shrubs, plants, fungi that exist in its environment, and it relies on the waters that flow through its land and such. So when I'm out in a natural place like this, next to a river, which is one of the veins of the landscape, I'm reminded of that deep sense of connection that we have to all things.
I wanted to ask about that, the relationship that you have with nature. How has being a druid impacted how you feel in your natural surroundings, how connected you feel to the landscape?
So I remember quite vividly when I was younger and I was just getting my head around paganism and magic and druidry. I remember I had a dream where I was sat right here, right on the banks of this river on a very hot summer's day. And I was looking over towards kind of where at the moment you see mostly brambles and such. There's also a little kind of outcrop of rocks, which almost looks like a little bank. And when I looked over in the dream, I saw a woman sat there, dressed entirely in white and with long flowing red hair. And I remember this dream came to me when I was in a very sensitive and very painful time in my life, when I was coming to terms with my identity, coming to terms with who I am as a person. And in this dream, I remember looking up and seeing this goddess-like figure sat there. And I remember she kind of waved to me with her hands as if to motion to hold my hands up as well. And then she'd cupped her hands and took some of the water of the river and washed her face with it. And I copied her motions and I washed my face. And when I woke up, it was almost as if I'd been refreshed, regenerated, changed and healed from the things that were paining me that day. And personally for me, that was one of the first occasions where I felt the presence of the divine in my life, reaching out to me via dream. And when I came here next for the physical time, not in dream, I remember that vision of her washing her face in the river was so vividly imprinted on my mind that that is what I always see when I come here now. I see her cupping her hands and telling me that the waters of this place will wash away all of those fears, all of those doubts, all of those feelings of heaviness that sometimes linger within us.
Tell me a little bit more about those feelings that lingered. What kind of things were you going through at that time? What was your relationship to your spiritual practice?
Well, I grew up in a very rural area, and as such, it was kind of daunting being anything that chafed against kind of the norm in that place. So I grew up as a person who was essentially always seen as the weirdo. I was always the person who had the strange interests, who wasn't into what everyone else was into. And then on top of that, I was also grappling with my identity, whether that was my gender identity or my identity as, you know, when it comes to sexuality and such. And in that period, that was around when I was 12 or 13 years old, and these feelings were really bubbling to the surface. And I remember in that moment, I felt broken. I just felt like there was something deeply wrong with me, that I didn't fit the mold that everybody else seemed to fit into, and people were so adamant to let me know that I didn't fit that mold. So it was kind of difficult to imagine and envision a life and a living for myself as I grew up where I was happy and content. And in those moments, I remember feeling like I had no friends. I didn't know any other queer people. I didn't know anyone who, you know, had gone through the things I was going through. And I didn't even know words like transgender or anything like that at that point. I was just completely oblivious to it all. And then these moments, like that dream, or finding books on witchcraft, or finding books on folklore, they kind of brought me out of that. They brought me to this place where I could escape into a realm of enchantment, where the world isn't black and white and binary in its thinking, where the world is much more expansive, expressive, and kaleidoscopic in its scope, and where a variety of different people who fit into various different ways and expressions of being could exist happily. And that was when I kind of found my people and my sense of self and stability.
Okay, Mara, where are we now?
So this is Bryn Cahiddi. So before you, you might see a mound of earth and a few stones scattered about in the middle of a field where there's a fence going all the way around us and such. But this monument right here, this landscape here, is one that humans have interacted with for thousands upon thousands of years. So this site is important to us in particular because it creates essentially a spiritual home for us. And right here to the right, there is a stone, and we usually place our hands on the stone and just spend a quick second in reflection and reverence of the space before we enter. So if you want to follow me.
Okay, we'll just place our hand gently on the stone. I'm very aware that if I was here without you, Mara, I wouldn't know any of this, and I'd probably walk in a circle and then leave without feeling this connection to the site.
A big aspect of our personal practice and our faith is a belief in sacred breath. So in this moment, as you're holding the rock, I'm going to ask you to just take 3 deep breaths in through the nose and out through the mouth, just as a way of acknowledging the sacred air and breath of this space. Breathe with the monument, essentially. And then we give a nod to the chamber and we enter.
Okay, so we're approaching the entrance. It looks dark in here. We'll just duck as we go through. Squeeze through some big stones. Oh, it's actually really cold. And you walk along a tunnel and the wind stopped.
Marvellous. So yes, this is the inner chamber of Bryn Cyhyddu. So
inside the chamber, there's a stone shelf where people have left little offerings. There's shells, pennies, painted rocks. But Mara prefers a different kind of offering.
Mon mam camere, cloaf tin galw. Mon mam camere, cloaf de gan. Mourn my mother, I hear you calling. Mourn my mother, I hear your song. Mourn mam camere, cloaf tin galw. Mourn mam camere, cloaf de gan. It's just call to the mother.
That was so beautiful, and the acoustics in here were actually incredible.
They are perfect.
Okay, we're going to leave this lovely space so people outside can also enjoy it. And we're going to duck back through the long stone tunnel. I can see the sunny blue skies at the end as we re-emerge into the sunlight.
Before we leave this site, I want to ask Mara about her thoughts on Druidry being recognised as a religion, which it was in the UK in 2010.
I tend to call it a religion for me personally, but I know that some people take huge umbrage at the idea of calling it religion. And I think the biggest reason behind the kind of feeling of unease with calling it a religion comes with the baggage that comes behind that word, religion. When people hear religion, they think of dogmatic, very controlling. And personally, because I was not raised religiously, because I did not grow up in a church, because I did not grow up surrounded by a very dogmatic religion, I don't have the same qualms about the word religion. And to me, it's a kind of a matter of semantics, where it's kind of like, what do we mean by religion? And to me, religion just means the way in which I walk my walk in the world, the way in which I interact with the divine, and the way in which I frame the life that I live. And my life is framed by ritual, my life is framed by my relationship to the natural world, but also my relationship to my gods. It's framed by my community and the way we gather together at certain times in the year, and it's framed by my belief in magic and in the innate living quality of the world around us. So to me, that sounds like a religion, but some people would wholeheartedly disagree.
I'm Maura Morrison, and for this week's Heart and Soul, I've come to Anglesey in Wales. I'm here to spend time with local witch and druid Mara Starling and learn about how druidry has transformed her life. One key person in this transformation is a man called Christopher Hughes, who's been the head of the Anglesey Druid Order for 25 years. I'm eager to know about his role in Mara's life. So we set off to meet him.
Okay, we have arrived at the office of the Anglesey Druid Order. We'll just come through the main door and hopefully we'll find Christopher. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Christopher. I'm Maura.
Hi, Maura. Chris, how are you?
Very good. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, yeah, good.
I'm well, here with a familiar face.
With a very familiar face. How are you both? Good?
Very good, yeah. We were hoping you could give us a tour of the headquarters.
I can. Well, welcome to the office of the Anglesey Druid Order.
Amazing. It's great to be here. It smells fantastic.
It does, doesn't it? I've got all sorts of lotions and potions burning to make it smell less like an old school and more like a druid's office.
Describe the smell. What have we gone for?
It's a blend of pine resin and copal. I think that's burning in the
I'd really love to go back to that moment where you guys first met. Mara, we were talking about this earlier by the river, and that feeling of acceptance when you became a druid. How pivotal was someone like Christopher in welcoming you into that community, and how did that change your relationship to your own community outside the druid community, your local community within Anglesey, and just how did that develop?
It was really meeting Christopher that came to this point in my life where I started seeing queer people, actual people who were living their lives, openly being themselves, and yet they weren't miserable, which is what I'd always been fed from as young of an age as I could remember. I remember people telling me that, you know, if you quote-unquote choose to be queer, not that it is a choice, then you are choosing a life that's going to be filled with misery, filled with depression, filled with angst and anguish and such. And so as a teenager, as a very kind of early teenager who was just coming to terms with who I was and was very malleable in that moment, it was really easy to kind of feel almost as if there was nowhere to go from there. So I remember at that age, I was very much in the mindset of, I'll move away to London or Manchester and I'll just blend into the crowds and I'll live my joyous little life in private and in secret. And then I met Christopher and it was like, oh no, you can live in a little cottage on Anglesey and live your brightest, most radiant queer existence whilst also fitting really well into community, but not sacrificing any aspect of your own authenticity in that process either. So there was this kind of, I remember that moment when I was sat in Christopher's office for the first time and I asked him a question. I don't remember what the question was now. And Christopher was just kind of waxing lyrically about this thing that I'd asked him. And I just remember I kind of zoned out and kind of disassociated for a moment. And I was just watching the way he moved and the way he talked. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, like this is an example of somebody who is somewhat like me. Like, I can see myself in him, but at the same time, he's not miserable and he's not living in complete anguish all the time, like everybody told me queer people constantly will be. He's a drag artist, he's a death professional, he's a druid, and not just a druid, the head of a druid order. He's part of this thriving community. And in that moment, it was kind of like, oh, this could be a life for me. This could be something that I could do in future. So it was almost like finding somebody who was a direct inspiration. And since that moment, Christopher has kind of been my main inspiration in life, my mentor and somebody I look to as kind of a figure that I really admire.
That's big words of praise. How do you feel?
I think within the spirit of Druidry, we have this concept called Awen, which means blessed holy breath. It's the creative outpouring of the universe itself. And it's often not mistranslated, but perhaps loses its nuance when it's translated simply as inspiration. But inspiration is certainly a part of Awen. And that is the task of any druid, of any magical practitioner, is to inspire. And I think when you have inspired and you feel that you've inspired, it inspires you to inspire more, right? So through all of my work, whether it's writing, whether it's television, my ultimate goal in life is to be as inspirational as I possibly can be and to glean inspiration from the people that inspire me and keep that wind, that breath of Awen continuously flowing, because We can very easily fall into anxiety. So many of us can become easily addicted to anxiety just by looking at the state of the world. Whereas we are able to find ways to transcend that anxiety and turn it into finding our own joy, whether that's through spirituality or through a hobby or through any other drive that somebody might be attracted towards. I think ultimately, if we can be forces of inspiration in the world, we leave a rather lovely legacy. You know, that
a lot of people might not have that positive relationship to a religious and spiritual practice. Why do you think it is that Druidry allows that?
I think by its very definition, Druidry, because of its tertiary component, so not that we denounce the binary, but rather we transcend the binary in seeing the universe running on a tertiary or a tripartite function. So you have dark and light, but you also have an energetic principle between them, dusk and dawn. And when you consider that the world is significantly more than just that which is visibly binary, that there is something else in between, it becomes something that attracts people towards it because they instinctively know on some level that I'll be welcomed with open arms in that particular community. It's not going to judge me if I feel that I am other, because we celebrate the other. I also felt othered when I was growing up, but I chose to use that otherness as a strength rather than as a weakness, or even worse, a perception of failure that somebody else might have placed upon me. I determined at a very young age that I can use this otherness to my own power and to my own empowerment, which I feel that I've succeeded in doing. But then, you know, it's an ongoing battle, right? It's an ongoing task to be able to maintain that, because we get caught up in daily life as well as caught up in the semantics and logistics of Druidry. And that whether you're a druid, whether you're a witch, or whatever other word you might use to describe yourself, it's simultaneously expressing mystery.
Okay, so I'm at an event which Mara and Chris are hosting called The Cosmology of Magic, which is all about magic, Welsh folklore, and the magic that we all have within to transform our own lives. There's around 40 people in the room. Let's find out why some of them have come.
Hello. Hi. I'm working on a documentary about Druidry on Anglesey for the BBC World Service. Would it be okay if I asked you a few questions?
You can ask some questions, whether we give any answers.
My name is Janet Farnell. I'm not actually a druid, so I'm not a member of the order, but I have been to one or two of their little shindigs, let's say. Yeah. But what I like about druidry is it's a simplicity, and probably that's why I prefer the druid Anglesey people. They seem to simplify everything, and it's about worshipping the earth. And we are here to look after the earth. Every one of us is an earth keeper, you know, and it's about respecting the water, respecting the seas, the land, the skies, and what lives in those elements as well, you know. So I just love it. I am a sound healer. I am a healer myself, you know. And I suppose really when I come here, I come in here for a little bit of spiritual nourishment as well. You know, it's like touching base. It's like touching base again.
I'm Sharon Thomas.
And Sharon, do you call yourself a druid?
I wouldn't call myself a druid, not at all, no. I'd say that I've been a very quiet and shy observer for quite a while. And this is my first time at a full druid event, apart from the open events at Solstice.
Okay, so what made you want to come today?
I've just tried to think how I'd sum that up, and I think personal development, and then connection with others, and then a wider connection outwardly, worldwide, I'd say. Yeah.
Would you call yourself a religious and or a spiritual person?
Definitely not religious, definitely spiritual. And that, again, is an individual thing and part of, you've brought it really nicely back to one of the reasons that I'm here, is that I'm wondering whether that my personal spiritualism is enough. It has been for a while, but I'm not sure whether it's enough now, whether, you know, it needs to be developed and grown. Yeah. I've been quite solitary, I think is the easiest way to put it. I've been a very, very solitary person, hence the solitary spiritualism and solitary learning. And I've kind of came here today to dip the toe into the community kind of thing, to give a taste of what the community, particularly Druidism, would feel like and you know, what it would feel like. Yeah.
So you've been a spiritual person within your own personal practices, and this is about seeing what a community would look like.
Yeah. And how I would feel. Because obviously, change can bring vulnerability, and having been vulnerable and still, although more empowered as a person, still an element of vulnerability, which we all have, whether that would feel comfortable or not for me.
This morning we've been learning a lot about magic. What does magic mean to you?
Oh, well, it's the spark within, I'd say. The spark within, connecting to that is greater than we are, you know. The goodness, unknown, wisdom, life. Yeah. I think without all of that, life would be very dull. Today, and what I've learned and what I've heard spoken about by Chris, it's definitely, it's ignited something. It's ignited something, and yeah, it's exciting. Yeah, it's really exciting.
Thank you both so much. I hope you have a fantastic day.
I don't think it's happened much to me because I tend to choose very isolated, secret places to do my things if I'm doing them outdoors and such. Or if
I've just asked Mara if she ever feels any form of persecution when she practices in public,
like the solstices and such. But I did have occasions in my youth when I was just getting started, and I would wander over to the trees behind my house, or I would go and, you know, stand in the fields in order to try and kind of like light a cauldron fire and do a few spells as like a plucky 16-year-old who was just getting started. And I'd have people making the odd comment here and there about, you know, like, are you getting up to some satanic stuff and all that? Are you going to get into something dangerous? And that kind of made me realize that maybe I don't need to be doing this in a field where people can watch. But also it made me realize how much of a stigma there is to anything that doesn't fit the standard mold of what we think of as religion and what we think of as spirituality. So, you know, to me, what I was doing out in the field was no different to the people who go to church every Sunday. It was my way of showing devotion to the world. It was my way of showing my love and my reverence for everything that I could see around me. But for some reason, doing it in a field meant that people thought it was shifty rather than something that was beautiful and lovely and devotional.
Doors that were opened.
Doors that were opened.
Be closed. It's the end of the day, and after a day learning about magic, we stand outside in a circle around a smoking cauldron. Many people have their eyes closed and their faces tilted towards the sun. Several step forward to give thanks to the land and offer poems. And then Chris brings the day to a close. And people start to drift off back to their lives.
Heart and Soul was presented and produced by Maura Morrison. Coming up in a few moments, the inmates who raise pigs, cattle and sheep on a prison farm. But first, we'll make way for some sniping siblings tomorrow.
Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders return to Radio 4 with a new series.
A series, you say?
You mean it's real? What is it this time?
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane Austen, a comedy about two sisters at war.
Selena, do you even have an attention span?
Well, certainly not anymore, you know, because of the 60s.
Written by David Quantick.
Let's talk about me again. Well, I don't wish to rain on your parade, Selena, but it sounds dreadful.
Oh, there we go, my mistake, moving on.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane Austen.
Out of the way, Florence!
Starts tomorrow at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now on BBC Radio 4, Charlotte Smith is at a farm in Kent, run by inmates at East Sutton Park Prison.
Come on, girls, come on! Whoop, whoop. Come on, girls! Come on, lovelies! Come on! Here they come. Aren't they beautiful?
They are the most beautiful sheep. So these are Herdwicks, a traditional English breed. They're the ones with the dark bodies, either grey or brown, depending, with white faces. And they're just really lovely sheep. And obviously very happy now because Pete brought food. How big is your commercial flock?
The commercial flock we're growing at the moment. So at the moment we're 35 Texel Cross sheep. We're going to go up to 50 or 60 eventually. Again, it's just to get the food into the prison. And we've only got 55 acres of grass, so we have to manage that very carefully.
It's a beautiful, autumn morning. Looking across this beautiful view of Kent, looking across a really wooded expanse. But actually, when I turn, I'm just making my way underneath a large brick archway through a rather grand entrance to a farm, and a very unusual farm. We're at East Sutton Park Women's Prison.
Morning.
Around 100 prisoners here, all women. And the farm has been part of this place pretty much since it became a prison back in the 1940s. The reason we've come here is that we're actually standing in a farmyard, and it isn't anything like I expected, because we're standing in what feels like an old Victorian brick farmyard. We've got pigs behind us, we've got people about to move animals around, and I haven't seen a key or a lock or anything since I got here. Why not?
East Sutton Park is classed as a Cat D prison, so we are basically looking to rehabilitate our prisoners, looking to get them ready to work on the outside. They've got to have a level of trust, and if that trust is broken, they will be sent back to closed prison. So there are rules here. We do have rules, and we do have doors that are locked that can't go in, etc. But the purpose of us is to get them out in the community, out into work, and to be citizens that earn their own money and not have to reoffend in order to get money. Part of the farm here is about training them and getting them ready to have the right employability skills, being part of the team, being part of the prison system, helping the prison to run, etc. I'm Susan Anderson, I'm Head of Education, Skills and Work.
So it's all about getting them jobs. Why a farm? How many people coming out of prison really want to work on a farm?
The farm, really, it's about mental health for a start, the well-being of them, and it's about getting the employability skills. You know, farming's not an easy job, so if they can get themselves out of bed, they can get themselves into the farm. They're expected to work as team players. They're expected to obviously have compassion for the animals and look after the well-being of the animals. So it's not just about being a farmer, it's about all the other employability skills that collect on the way, and it's really about the general well-being and being part of something within East Sutton Park.
Quebec 4 to enter an R. Can you take me off the neck, please? I should have done it first.
Walkie-talkie on at all times. I'm just following Pete Stanley, who's the farm manager here. And we're walking out of sort of the entrance, if you like, to the farm, and around the corner towards the piggery. Pete, what sort of age are all these farm buildings?
We've inherited a very old traditional farm, and the way we work on the farm is very hand-to-fork wheelbarrows. We don't use a lot of tractors and so on. So the farm itself is well over 100 years old.
We've got a tractor here just on our right, but we are talking small tractors and not very many of them.
No, small tractors, so we can train the girls up. We take them out into the fields, we do a lot of field work. But currently we're moving a little bit away from that and we're looking at the ecological side of it, because being southeast of England, everything's changing dramatically. We've had a very difficult farming year that I'm sure you all understand, and things have changed a lot. So we're now doing a lot of things like conservation grazing. We're using pigs for conservation grazing. We've got some rare breed Herdwick sheep that we're using for conservation grazing. And what it does, it gives us a chance for the girls to look at the complexities of the environment and see how attractive changes the grass in the field, how a sheep can change the grass in the field, and we can look at what that produces in the spring and see how that differs.
So it's not just sort of farming, it's everything, conservation, why we do what we do, how we do what we do.
Absolutely. So it's a very long process. So I've been here just under a year and we're regenerating the farm. We've got some new staff and we've got some new equipment and we're working hard to move it forward.
This one's a pigs.
Come in here.
Women then will work down in the piggery at any one time?
Well, we have up to 10 ladies on the farm to do all the work. Normally two or three in the piggery every morning. And we train them up on different sections. They start off in here. One of the biggest problems here is overfeeding rather than underfeeding. The ladies can get a little bit excited on their favourite pigs, so we monitor all of those. But that's something I talk to them about. So we have a team meeting every morning. Sometimes we'll have a team leader. One of the girls will run a team somewhere, and that's all part of their development.
So we've got four pig pens in this part of the piggery, and these are large pig pens, which honestly looks like it could have been a set from Downton. It's pretty old. They've got a little area where the piglets can be, because we've got 4,000 loads of piglets, and then they've got a little door which takes them outside, and actually as we came past you had at least one sow just lying in the sunshine enjoying life. What sort of pigs are they? Because we've got some spotty ones.
Absolutely. So everything we produce goes into our prison kitchen and surrounding prison kitchens. So what we're trying to do, and when you speak to our butcher later, we're trying to produce the best carcass possible. So we want a nice, good quality, lean meat, very long carcass. To build that, we need three breeds of pig. I can't tell you my three breeds of pig, because that's a closely guarded secret, because we're making the best carcass possible.
Seriously?
And we've won, yeah, absolutely, we've won carcass shows, and we work with master butchers.
You have a guaranteed market, though, don't you? Because it's all going to go into the prison.
Yes,
whatever
it is.
You produce.
It is. But by making the pigs better, by producing the perfect carcass, if you can get a pig that's an extra 6 centimetres long, you'll get an extra 12 chops off that. And if you're getting 12, 14 pigs to the litter, that's an awful lot of meat off that pig. And they'll eat the same amount of food. So we're making more produce under the same costs going into the butchery. We've got a little farm shop on site that's open on a Friday afternoon and a Saturday morning. And so the prime cuts of our meat go through the farm shop to the local community, so we feed the local community as well.
Well, just outside the piggery actually are some of the women who work here on the farm. We're not going to use their real names, so let's call them Alice and Lisa. Alice, just tell me why you are working here on the farm.
So when I arrived here, it was my first port of call. I come from the countryside. To me, farming is something really special to the country, and I know many farmers. So to come here and to be involved myself was a privilege. I just found it to be just a brilliant escape from everything, not only within the prison, but in anything I've ever known. The chance to work outside with animals is just fabulous.
Even though you grew up in the countryside, did it ever occur to you before coming here that farming was something you wanted to try?
So I come from a horsey family. So farming and horses, they work alongside but not quite together. So it's always been something I'd love to have given a go. So I'm happy to be doing it.
And what do you do on an average day on the farm?
We sort the pigs out, we feed them, we muck them out, make sure they're comfortable, they're happy, they're healthy. maintenance, tidying, fixing, anything, anything at all.
It's sort of endless, isn't it, when you start on a farm?
It is. It completely is. There is always work on a farm. There are always leaves falling off trees, always pigs escaping, just always something. An endless but wonderful job.
Do you like working with the pigs? Because they can be, you know, sows are very big and very protective of their piglets. How does that go?
I love it. I think you have to respect them as mothers, firstly, and they act as any woman would. If someone was coming in with, we have tools, we are often wearing waterproofs, we are imposing, so you respect them and they give you that back.
What about when they go off to the abattoir?
So going off to the abattoirs are kind of a sheltered affair here. We know that they're going, and we know, obviously we know abattoirs and what they entail and the end product, but we keep our pigs, we name them, but we don't really form specific friendships and bonds with them. We love them all equally, so when the end of their story comes, you know, we understand the reality of farming here.
Do you think you might go on to work in farming? Or has this ruled that out completely?
No, if anything, it's made me want to be a farmer. It's made me want to seek work in the farming industry, and if not, then just outside, because to be outside is really quite, it's monumental in how it makes you feel.
Do lots of people want to work on the farm, or is it just a select few of people who are tempted?
So there is a waiting list to work on the farm. This is a sought-after job. It's very trying. You get covered in, obviously, every kind of matter that a farm brings with it. But it is desired here, definitely. It comes with so many things that people have never seen, and it can teach people and let them into a world that they would not usually have the opportunity to enter. So, yes, I feel privileged to work here because everyone wants to work on the farm.
Also with us is another of the people who volunteers to work here on the farm, who we're going to call Lisa. Lisa, what was your experience of farming before here?
I didn't have any experience of farming, but I also come from an equine background. So I've horses have been in my life growing up in Oxfordshire. I live near farms. I've always known about farms and stuff.
So what is it that attracted you to come and actually work?
I love the outdoors, I love the animals, I love being close to nature. It's really amazing. And we're a good team here, a fantastic team of people.
As we're talking, one of the pigs has come out to say hello. Who's
Petunia.
This?
Petunia.
You're kidding me.
Petunia.
Lovely. She's honestly one of the most friendly pigs.
Alice is just leaning over and scratching her ears. And she's... You're very happy, aren't you?
Yeah. More than...
Petunia? Where did Petunia. That come from?
A lot of them were named after the officers, I believe.
Crikey. I think we'll just leave that there, shall we? So would you consider working outside in on farms when you get out?
Yes, I would. I'd like to work on a city farm, voluntary, when I get out of prison.
That's a lot. That's children and animals all
yeah,
at once.
Yeah, love it.
I mean, lots of people would run screaming for the hills at that point.
No, it's fabulous. Fantastic.
So which animals do you like working with the best?
The pigs.
Really?
Yeah.
What about sheep?
The sheep are okay, yeah. They're lovely, they're beautiful, but the pigs, I think, are the business.
Alice, sheep?
I'd say pigs as
really?
Well. They are a unanimous favourite because you see them in every... aspect of their life, as mothers, as boars, as weaners, so the teenage stage, and obviously the piglets. When I first came here, I thought the piglets would be the highlight, but it's not. The sows, when just watching how they take to motherhood instinctually is just amazing. Pigs, it's changed my whole perception, and I think for anyone that comes to the farm, I'm and like always bringing people down. Just look at them. They're not what you think. And a lot of people, they're like, yeah, they are actually quite beautiful.
So, it's an opinion. He is set off at a clip here. Where are we going? This way, right.
I get very excited.
I have to say, the view here is absolutely absolutely stunning. We're a little bit up high and we're looking right out across this wooded patchwork field of Kent. Do you ever have problems? Because these are women who've been through it. They've obviously done something wrong. That's why they're in prison. It can't always be as easy and jolly as it seems.
No, absolutely. We have a healthcare unit on site and we work with them. And as they come into the prison, when they're first into the prison, they're assessed and so on and so forth. And whether that be physicalities or mental health. And we work with them in various ways. So we've got ways of working with everyone. So if someone's got any sort of physical disability, they can still work on the farm. We can just do light duties in some way or at some different part of the farm or the gardens. We have girls working in the greenhouses, putting up seed trays ready for next year and so on. So we're as all inclusive as we can on the farm and gardens.
Do you see changes in them, in the people who come and work on the farm over, I mean, on average, how long do they spend with you?
It varies greatly. We can have people here for a year or so. We can have people here for 6 or 7 or 8 weeks at a time. We do see a dramatic change. They don't know what to expect of a farm. Many of them have never worked on a farm. Some of them have never had a job before. So you have to start off with the very basics of sweeping, tidying up, and the rights and wrongs of looking after animals and feeding animals and livestock and grassland management and so on. But the change is when they just start to enjoy it and they love it.
Susan Anderson's still with us, in charge of education and training here at the prison. Some people are going to listen to this and they're going to think these women are actually having quite a nice time and they're supposed to be in prison. Is that a fair criticism?
No, they're here for rehabilitation, so they are here to learn new skills. They're here to learn how to turn up to work on time, to get used to getting out of bed and doing a day's worth of work and getting them ready for the real world. So, you know, and I think one of the hardest jobs is working on the farm, working out, especially in the winter. It's beautiful today, an autumn day, but in the winter, this is a cold, frosty, wet environment to be in. So it's certainly not an easy place to be. But the skills they learn, you know, the tractor driving, that can be took on to other warehouse jobs and things. They're all transferable. The teamwork that the girls talked about when they're doing the CVs and when they're doing the interviews, they've got experiences to talk about to go on the CVs as well. So that, again, helps them to get the job on release, which is what we want to do. We want to rehabilitate them so they don't come back to prisons again.
Are we just walking past a walled garden here?
It's a really beautiful old traditional walled garden. On the other side, we've got allotments that we have for staff. It's also about the staff, so it's about the staff mental wellbeing as well. So we do, some of them come and do allotments, some of them work with the ladies on the allotments, and that's their peace of mind. And you'll come to the butchery shortly, and you'll meet our bearded butcher, Howard, and he does sausage making sessions with the staff as well. So it's not just about the prisoners, it's about the staff as well. We also hear it's not just about the meat and the livestock. We've got polytunnels, we grow our own veg, we also grow all the flowers and so for the estate gardens and the hanging baskets and so on, and that we sell through the farm shop and everything.
Should talk briefly about your sartorial elegance this morning, I think, because you are resplendent in practical farming chaps over your jeans and neatly ironed shirt, but pièce de résistance, and I'm told you never take this off, leather cowboy hat.
Absolutely. I think it's the way forward. With the British weather, everyone should wear a hat. I don't know why people don't wear more hats. This is our traditional farming attire. I did iron my shirt this morning, especially for the radio. Not sure why I did that.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's a little bit iconic, the hat, but I'm well noted around the prison. They can see me coming.
So here is the bearded butcher, Howard Newcombe. Howard, there seems to be something of a dress code here on the farm for the men, in that you too are wearing a leather cowboy hat. What's this
That's
about?
I picked this up around about 20 years ago from Australia when I went over there, and I've worn all sorts of hats whilst I've been on the farm, but I actually find this one that's actually the most comfortable, and it also offers a little bit of protection for my bonds.
So, talk me through the butchery. How does this work?
This is the butchery. So, it kind of breaks down into three areas here. So, we've got the dry store there where it's all my ingredients. There's a few freezers in there because we primarily provide meat to other prisons. The animals that we breed here are then put through our butchery by the ladies. We put them into freezers and they go off to the prisons. We have got scope for a little bit of our produce to end up in a farm shop that's opened a couple of days a week, but yeah, primarily for the prisons.
And how about the women who want to work with you? Do they want these skills so that they can go and do it on the outside?
Yes.
Or?
Yeah, so the majority, they want to come in, they want to learn a skill, and they're interested in the farm to fork, and I try to pass on as much as I can, because we make our own sausages here, we cure our own bacon, I show them all these skills, you know, how to use the knives correctly, how to sharpen them, things like that.
Susan, I can't be the only person thinking prisoners' knives, is this wise?
Yeah, I mean, as I said before, our ladies, they're all classed as low risk. They don't just get put into any work area. You know, we do check and make sure that they're all suitable for it. But when they come here, they are classed as suitable. We don't just have prisoners land here that are not ready to be working.
Do you know how many actually go on to work on farms or in butcheries or get jobs directly related to what they've done here?
I mean, I think one of the issues that we face is that a lot of our prisoners are not from the local area. So even if we release them and they want to go into farming, they may be going back to more of an urban area, therefore they're going to struggle. But the purpose of it is that we've developed their employability skills. For example, their tractor skills, their forklift truck skills. They've got the knife skills that can go into kitchens. They must have a food hygiene certificate in order to come and work with Howard in the first place. So again, that allows them to go into cafes and to restaurants, etc. So it's not necessarily they go and work in a butcher or they're going to work in a farm. They can work in something similar. So it's just using the transferable skills that we're helping them to develop.
One of the ladies that worked here, she set up a business making sausages. Last year, we had a lady, she became a qualified butcher, and she was here teaching butchery skills, and she left. And when she left, she went to work, and she took a couple of the ladies with her as well. So we have had some successes from the farm and from the butchery.
So this, I'm guessing, is Angus?
Yeah, they're Aberdeen Angus. They've been brought to us from another prison up near Blackpool. So we share livestock from other prison farms.
How big can you get? Is there, because it's only what, 88 acres?
Yeah, it's just under 100 acres all told, and that we can't get any bigger than that. So we just need to utilise the land that we've got in the best way possible. And that's, like I say, that's why we're bringing in new breeds, new sheep, new breeds of pig. We've got some Hampshire Tamworth pigs that we're going to utilise in a wooded area. So it's about utilising every acre we've got to produce as much as we can within our budget restrictions for our prison and the surrounding prisons, and to do it with the girls working alongside us.
On Your Farm from East Sutton Park Prison in Kent was presented by Charlotte Smith. The producer was Rebecca Rooney. Time now to turn our thoughts to today's weather prospects. So let's say good morning to Simon King.
Neil, thank you so much indeed. Good morning. Yes, we've got some pretty wet weather out there this morning. A band of rain moving its way from west to east, all linked into an area of low pressure, which is going to move in across northern areas of the UK today. And to the south of that, it means we've got some fairly strong winds. So for southwest England and Wales, gusty winds up to about 40, 50 miles an hour, especially around coastal areas through today. We've had some rain early on this morning. That's pretty much cleared, but some showers follow. And I think we'll see some showers continuing, mainly around western areas into the afternoon. But there'll also be some sunny spells for many, and temperatures getting up to about 7 to 11 degrees. Now, for the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, we've got some pretty heavy rain out there this morning, especially across eastern England. That's going to quickly clear away to the east, and then we're going to see some sunshine developing. So, looking like a sunny afternoon, quite breezy, with temperatures of 9 to 11 Celsius. Now, for northern England, again, some heavy rain, especially to the northeast of England, clearing away to the east. There'll be a little bit of sunshine for a time, but then we will see the cloud increasing again with some frequent showers throughout this afternoon and highs of 6 to 8 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, central and southern Scotland, again, just this heavy rain this morning moving eastward, but it's going to pivot into central and southern Scotland. So we're going to see frequent showers here. Showers also quite widely across Northern Ireland well into this afternoon. It's all because the area of low pressure is just going to move through these areas. So the wind's not particularly a problem, but it will stay quite wet today with highs of 5 to 8 Celsius. And for northern Scotland, a few sunny spells, but also, again, a few showers, particularly towards northeastern Scotland, highs of 6 or 7 degrees. Now, through tonight, it will stay quite showery. Temperatures overnight down to 3 to 6 degrees. And as we go through Monday, further showers likely, mostly towards eastern areas. Further west, there'll be some sunny spells. But again, some fairly strong winds, particularly for Wales and southwest England. Neil, back to you.
All right, many thanks, Simon King. We're discussing the nation's favourite school hymn on Sunday at 7:10.
The stories we tell.
About the people we know.
And the places we love.
Are not just made here.
They're stories made of here.
The British Isles are globally important for nature.
Yeah, we might find that kid who's got the raw talent, who's in a back street in Preston somewhere. That'd be amazing.
The thing is,
we're moving back to Barry.
What?
Made of Belfast.
Liverpool. Cornwall. Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 23rd of November. Good morning, this is Jane Steele. President Trump has said his plan to end the war in Ukraine is not his final offer ahead of talks on the draft deal in Geneva. Regulated rail fares in England are to be frozen from next year for the first time in three decades. A gold pocket watch belonging to a first-class passenger on the Titanic has sold at auction for a record price. Delegations from Ukraine and the US, as well as European security chiefs, will meet in Geneva later today to discuss President Trump's controversial 28-point plan to end the war with Russia. The proposals would see Kiev hand territory to Moscow and place limits on the size of Ukraine's armed forces. The US president had set President Zelensky a deadline of Thursday to accept the draft deal, but has now appeared to suggest there's room for manoeuvre. Here's our World News correspondent, Joe Inwood.
As he boarded his helicopter at the White House, President Trump was asked, "Is this your final offer to Ukraine?" His answer, "No, not right now," will have given a glimmer of hope to Ukraine and its supporters and suggested that today's talks could bear fruit. For Kyiv, hope has been in short supply ever since details emerged of a peace plan widely seen as one-sided in Russia's favour. As well as top Ukrainian and US officials, European national security advisers will be taking part in today's talks, hoping to get rid of any territorial concessions or limits on Ukraine's armed forces. In a joint statement yesterday, the leaders of the UK, EU, Japan and Canada said the 28-point plan required additional work. In diplomatic terms, a stinging criticism.
The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who's heading to Geneva to the talks, has insisted the White House-Ukraine plan was drawn up by the US. He was responding to claims from three senators who said they'd been told by Mr. Rubio that it was a Russian wish list. The COP30 UN climate summit in Brazil has closed. A final deal came hours after the official deadline and was judged by many to be nowhere near ambitious enough. There was a promise of more funding to help poorer nations, but no explicit mention of the fossil fuels that drive global warming. Our climate editor Justin Rowlett has spent the past 2 weeks at the talks in the city of Belém.
The outcome of this latest COP conference was, most observers agree, underwhelming. The Brazilian hosts said it would be about turning promises into action. Instead, it was basically just a reaffirmation of previous COP agreements. But these deals are done by consensus. Everyone has to agree. And that means the results are almost always an uncomfortable compromise that leaves pretty much everybody disappointed. You've also got to look at the context, say supporters of the system. The political environment is fractured and divided and, says Ed Miliband, the UK Energy Secretary, getting 194 countries to agree on anything is an achievement. But that won't stop people saying this unwieldy global process has to change.
Some train fares in England are to be frozen next year for the first time in decades as part of broader government plans to transfer rail services back into public ownership. The Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, said the freeze meant commuters would be able to keep more of their hard-earned cash. Here's our transport correspondent, Katie Austin.
When the rail network was privatised in the 1990s, some fares in England and Wales were regulated. They have gone up every year, except 2010, when the system of usually linking the annual fare cap to the RPI measure of inflation led to a decrease. The rise this year was 4.6%. The freeze announced today, which will last until March 2027, will apply to nearly half of ticket types, including season tickets and peak returns, but not to any time or advance tickets. The Campaign for Better Transport welcomed the move, citing costs as the number one concern for people wanting to travel by train. The government also said the freeze would help to limit inflation.
All schools in the state of Niger in Nigeria have been ordered to close following a mass kidnapping. More than 300 children and staff were abducted from a Catholic boarding school on Friday. It's thought the unidentified kidnappers are likely to be part of a criminal gang seeking ransoms. A House of Lords committee is warning that autistic people in England still face unacceptable inequalities, 16 years on from the passing of the Autism Act. In a new report, peers say the disparities are holding back autistic people from living fulfilling lives, and they urge the government to deliver real and lasting change. Graeme Satchell reports.
The peers examined life for autistic people in England from education and employment to life expectancy. They acknowledged that the 2009 Autism Act was a step forward in recognising the neurodiversity, but said successive governments had failed to deliver real change. More than 200,000 people are waiting for an autism assessment. Autistic children, the report says, often don't enjoy school, and just 30% of autistic adults are in work. The committees urge the government to improve initial assessment times, provide lifelong support, and to incentivise employers to help more autistic people thrive in work. A Department of Health spokesman said the government was committed to improving the lives of autistic people, ensuring they received high-quality, empathetic and dignified care.
A gold pocket watch recovered from a passenger who drowned during the sinking of the Titanic has sold for almost £1.8 million at an auction at Devizes in Wiltshire. The watch belonged to the American businessman Isidore Strauss, who died along with his wife Ida when they refused a place in a lifeboat. The auctioneer, Andrew Aldridge, says their story has been told many times, including in the 1997 James Cameron film.
He and his wife have been portrayed pretty much in every dramatisation and movie relating to the Titanic since the year dot. If you look at Cameron's dramatisation of the couple, at the end of the movie, you'll note that there were an elderly couple lying on their bed in their stateroom as the water envelops them, holding each other, and that's Isidore and Ida Strauss. So, in effect, they were a love story.
Formula One, Red Bull's Max Verstappen has won the Las Vegas Grand Prix. The British McLaren driver Lando Norris came second, picking up valuable points to extend his lead in the Drivers' Championship. Britain's George Russell, who drives for Mercedes, came third. That's the news. Now for a look at the Sunday papers, many of which focus on answers the Prime Minister gave to reporters at the G20 summit asking about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. The Mail on Sunday says Sir Keir Starmer has piled pressure on the former prince to testify to the US Congress about what he knew about Jeffrey Epstein. The former Duke of York has so far ignored requests by American politicians to come forward with any information. Sir Keir said it was ultimately up to Andrew, but that anybody with information about what he called these kind of cases should give evidence. The paper claims it as an exclusive, but the story features on the front of several other papers. The Sunday People says Sir Keir refused to comment on the case of the former prince directly, but said, if you have relevant information, you should be prepared to share it. The Sunday Times and Sunday Telegraph both point out that Congress cannot force foreign nationals to appear before its committee. England's dramatic loss from a position of strength in cricket's first Ashes test in Australia dominates the sports pages. Writing in the Sunday Telegraph, the former England batsman, Sir Geoffrey Boycott, says, I can't take stupid England seriously, highlighting what he calls reckless batting and a refusal to listen to criticism. In the Sunday Times, which devotes six pages to the defeat, the former England captain Mike Atherton says the loss was one of the most discouraging under the current leadership of Ben Stokes and the coach Brendan McCullum. The Observer describes the England players as having to peel themselves off the pitch in a state of disbelief they had surrendered such a strong position. Ahead of her budget on Wednesday, the Sunday Times says the Chancellor is preparing to spend £3 billion to end the two-child benefit cap. But it reports she has also insisted the government will make another attempt to reform welfare. The Sunday Telegraph says the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has accused Rachel Reeves of cowardice for refusing to admit she will raise taxes by freezing thresholds for another 2 years. The paper's editorial says all the signs are pointing to a brutal assault on Middle England in the budget, squeezing people in work to pay for those on benefits. The Chancellor herself tells the Sunday Mirror that she's going to tackle the cost of living crisis. She says working families will be at the front of her mind on Wednesday. The Sunday Telegraph says a move by a Chinese company to take over Thames Water could be blocked. It reports that the government has been urged not to let CK Infrastructure take a controlling stake in the huge water company, which services 16 million customers across London and the South East and is more than £20 billion in debt. One human rights campaigner warns such a takeover could literally allow China to switch off the taps. Finally, the Daily Express reports that the RAF is considering allowing overweight pilots to use weight loss drugs. The paper notes fighter pilots face strict limits on their weight so they can safely eject from aircraft. I'll look at the papers.
Many thanks, Jane Steele. Now on BBC Radio 4, time for Sunday with William Crawley.
Thanks very much. Good morning. A landmark Supreme Court decision this week ruled that Northern Ireland's Christian-centred RE curriculum is unlawful. We will explore the possible implications of that judgment for religious education in schools across the UK. We'll also talk to the Labour MP Sir Chris Bryant as he reflects on his faith, his sexuality and his life before politics as a Church of England vicar.
The Church of England was going through one of its regular periods of kind of moral panic about homosexuality. Gay clergy often took on many of the difficult inner city roles, but they were condemned to a life of loneliness.
And later today, we will discover the nation's favourite school hymn. Might this be a contender? If there's a school hymn or song that has lived with you throughout your entire life, we'd love to hear about it. Tell us. Your email's to sunday@bbc.co.uk. The Police Service of Northern Ireland, the PSNI, have launched a criminal investigation into the safeguarding work of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. That announcement was made last Monday by Assistant Chief Constable Davy Beck.
I have established a dedicated PSNI investigation team under the supervision of an experienced senior investigating officer. This officer will lead what I can confirm today will be a criminal investigation. This investigation will seek to establish victims of offending and the perpetrators, and to investigate if criminal offences have been committed by those responsible for safeguarding.
And the Presbyterian Church has pledged to fully assist the police with their inquiries. The Presbyterian Church has dominated the news in Northern Ireland for the past 10 days since their moderator, the Reverend Trevor Gribben, resigned at a press conference, then refused to take any questions from the media. That's the first resignation by a serving moderator of that church in its 185-year history.
We're aware of a number of people who have been harmed. We believe that there may be others as yet unknown to us. We apologise unreservedly for this.
Church officials have admitted that the church's central safeguarding work was for more than a decade flawed and dysfunctional. They have acknowledged failures to refer concerns to statutory bodies, inconsistent record keeping, inadequate responses to safeguarding disclosures, and a lack of monitoring of ex-offenders in congregations. Next month, an emergency General Assembly of the Church will be held in Belfast, and there are now calls for a full independent inquiry to understand how and why the Church failed in its basic safeguarding duties and for so long. Jim Gamble is a former senior PSNI officer who later served as head of CEOP, the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Command, which is now part of the National Crime Agency. He's currently auditing safeguarding across dioceses in the Church of England. Jim, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, William.
First of all, on this move by the police, how unusual is this? How significant is it?
Well,
The fact that David Beck used the phrase investigating the Presbyterian Church is unprecedented in my experience. I understand the police investigating individuals where there have been complaints that indicate possible criminal activity, but investigating in those terms an institution, and an institution like the Church of England, is something I've not seen, like the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, is something I've not seen before.
At this point, Jim, what can we say on the record, as it were, about where PCI have failed?
Oh, look, PCI, I think, have failed across
PCI
the board.
PCI being the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, I should say.
Yeah, so I think when it comes to PCI, they've failed in a number of ways. And if you take the statement, there were far more questions than answers in it. They're dealing in ambiguity. They're talking about the central safeguarding function failing. If your central safeguarding function fails, you can have no reassurance in the frontline safeguarding going on in each of the 500 churches across the presbytery, because the central safeguarding should be the professional aspect of what's done, whereby in the presbyteries, in the churches, in the frontline, you've got volunteers. So the fact that sex offenders may have been attending without proper safety plans, a real concern. The fact that people may have suffered abuse in a faith-based environment where they should feel safe is a critical concern. The absence of record keeping, the fact that leadership is now trying to kick the can down the road. That's one of the most worrying things of all. What you look for here is a little bit of humility, the ability to self-reflect, but there's a lot more ambiguity being added because the church is saying, well, we're undertaking a Section 12 audit, as if that is an independent audit. It's basically a tick box exercise of guidance that's given out by the Safeguarding Board for Northern Ireland so that schools and other types of bodies can self-check that they've got risk assessments, that they've got policies, that they've got staff training, and they understand referral procedures. But it doesn't test the application of that, and it will not restore public confidence in an organisation that even now is failing to recognise the seriousness of the position that it's in.
And in a statement read to congregations last weekend, the Presbyterian Church referenced that self-administered online tool, the Section 12 audit, and said that that was an example of them embracing external review or external audit. That's now being challenged by the Safeguarding Board.
Well, the way it was announced is an example of how they don't seem to realise the seriousness of the position they're in. They're not going to be able to simply pause and wait until they can go back to business as normal. I wonder what the Charity Commission is doing in all of this. And I know that they may have had some conversation at the beginning when the Presbyterian Church said, look, we've identified a few failings internally and we're going to address them. But we've come to a point where the Charity Commission needs to apply its powers, because it's quite clear that the Presbyterian Church in Ireland hasn't got the ability to reflect to the point where it brings in an independent, a fundamentally independent root and branch audit, because that's what's needed. So the Charity Commission really are found wanting at this moment in time.
And just finally, Jim, there's pressure growing on the church to make a public statement to release church members or former employees who have settled with them in employment or other disputes with a non-disclosure agreement, which some critics have described as a kind of gagging order. It's a confidentiality clause within an agreement. Do you think it's unusual that churches would be using non-disclosure agreements?
I think it is unusual for them to use it. I think it is wrong for a faith-based environment to pay people off to keep them quiet. And I think moving forward, the law is very likely to change in that regard so that it's not allowable. But moreover, I think the law will look back, and anyone who's subject to an NDA now is likely to be released from it. But can I just say this? They could do well to look across the water at what the Church of England are doing. They're not perfect, and they have aggregated harms from the past, you know, that might make this pale a little bit. But they have grasped the nettle. They are following through ICSA 1 to 8 recommendations, and they are on a significant safeguarding improvement journey. You cannot begin that journey until you recognise that you're in the wrong place.
Jim, thank you very much. Jim Gamble. The Labour MP Sir Chris Bryant's journey to Parliament was far from conventional, some might even call it unorthodox. Before entering politics, he was a Church of England priest and later a BBC executive. Before that, he was a teenage actor, a caregiver to his struggling family and a young activist on the streets of Latin America. I've been speaking to Chris Bryant about his new memoir, A Life and a Half, which offers a very candid and often harrowing account of his personal life before politics, living in Franco Spain, coming out as gay, and navigating worlds as varied as drag clubs, parish churches, and eventually the corridors of power.
I loved being a priest, though, I mean, one of the things about the priestly vocation is it's quite repetitive. Some of my moments as a priest were immensely privileged. The very first person I took communion to just after I'd been ordained as a deacon was an old lady who was bedridden. I knocked on the door, went in, gave her communion, and as I held her hand, she passed away. She died. That's a phenomenal moment of privilege to be there with somebody. And I think lots of clergy talk about how people will sometimes let themselves go when a priest is there with them.
I was really taken by your many descriptions of life as a priest in the Church of England, from the sincerity of so many people you met and the world you were in, to the duplicity as well. I think at one point you used the word subterfuge, describe some of the people you met in that world. Looking back on it, how would you assess it?
The really difficult thing at the time was the Church of England was going through one of its regular periods of kind of moral panic about homosexuality. And of course, I was trying to work out whether I was gay or straight or not. And in that mix, there was a time when the line was, don't ask, don't tell. And then went, oh, hang on, Christian teaching says no. And that was very difficult because, well, look, I remember one bishop saying to me that he felt terribly upset because he had to appoint somebody to a new living in an inner city area. And he said every single priest in that deanery was gay. And so he felt he ought to appoint a straight person to the other, to the remaining parish. Now, of course, I mean, that's completely different from what anybody would think. But it was true that gay clergy often took on many of the difficult inner city roles, but they were condemned to a life of loneliness. And this, I remember telling my mother that I was gay. She was in the van with me because we were taking all their furniture. She was moving house. Mum was alcoholic, so it was all quite complicated. And she said to me two things. First of all, that she should always have known I was gay because of the funny way I walk. You can make of that what you will. But she also said, the thing is, you'll be lonely. And I think that that was one of the big things for a lot of gay men at the time, because, of course, you couldn't live with somebody because that was to reveal your sexuality.
There is a lot in the book about practical ministry aspects of the church. That could be conversational, it could be actual practical ministry by the church. Not much at all about preaching by you. I'm wondering, did you enjoy preaching? What kind of a preacher were you?
I've got all my old sermons,
have
funny
you?
Enough.
Have you?
I have, wow. Yes, they're in a box at home. I mean, there are people who argue that in my politics today, I'm a bit too preachy as well. And I loved liturgy. I loved the sense of order that it gave. There was lots of disorder in my life. Perhaps that's why I sought order in the church. My texts weren't necessarily always biblical. I think I gave one sermon which was all about Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and tackling the thuggies, bringing life to a new village. I tried to make things relevant, to use exemplars that were in people's ordinary life.
Do you still, these days as a politician, do you still have any kind of moral qualms that might come from that world about the things that are expected of you?
I'm a bit like John Dunrat, really. No man is an island entire unto himself. Seek not to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Every man's death affects me, all of that. And that's because I believe in teamwork. And that was true in the church as well. I mean, I remember there used to be lots of Anglo-Catholic clergy who didn't believe in some of the 39 articles of religion, and consequently they didn't do up all the 39 buttons on their cassock just to show that. I suppose every Christian has bits of accepted gospel which, they have difficulties with, and that is exactly the same in politics as well. And if I'm honest, my version of my Christian faith, as I say in the book, was always very much the Gospel of Mark. And I suppose that sense of mystery for me is just as important about my understanding of the Christian faith as anything else. One of my favourite words in any language is ojalá. It's a sort of Arabic Spanish word which means if only or I would that. And it has an element of regret about it, because there are things about my life that I wish would have been otherwise. I wish I'd been able to look after my mother better or to understand her alcoholism better. I wish I'd been able to be more supportive of some other people in my life or sort out my sexuality earlier. I wish I hadn't had to wait for my girlfriend Donna to wake me up one morning and say, Christopher, you do know you're gay, by the way, don't you? but I'm eternally optimistic about what is possible. And for that matter, I am about in my politics as well. I think resilience is a really important part of political life. I think there's too much bitterness and sourness in the way we conduct our political debate often. But I try not to be too pious, or pie, as my grandmother would call it, the Scottish sort of version of piousness.
Chris Bryant there, and his new book is called A Life and a Half. In Crumpsall, Manchester, a small Eritrean Orthodox congregation has marked an historic milestone, the ordination of its first priest in the UK, 10 years after breaking away from the main church. For many in the diaspora, it is a long-awaited moment of spiritual renewal. But behind the hymns lies a more complex story, one that reflects a global fracture within the Eritrean Orthodox Church, rooted in government interference and contested religious authority. Eritreans, incidentally, account for almost 7% of all asylum seekers in the UK, making them the fourth most common nationality. Baraatu Ibrahim visited the congregation and spoke to worshippers and clergy about faith, politics, and the quiet struggle to stay united in a divided spiritual landscape.
The small church, which split from the main church 10 years ago, now has its first ordained priest in the UK. For many Eritreans in the UK diaspora, it's a long-awaited moment.
My name is Sarah. I'm 19 years old. It genuinely brings us joy because now we have a priest. It was pretty hard, you know, being able to pull off some ceremonies because we had to do them really rarely, because the priests that used to come here, they would have to come here like on schedule. For 2 months we wouldn't have them, so we would have to do the basic church ceremonies.
My name's Hannah Itabarak. It's really moving to see Abunakashi Johannes become a priest after all these years. He's a real pillar in our community.
Presiding over the event is 95-year-old Bishop Macarius, who came all the way from the US. Ordained in 1991, Bishop Macarius has long served the Eritrean Orthodox Tewahedo Church in the diaspora and is a recognized authority within the Standing Conference of Oriental Orthodox Church.
We've got women and children now lining up to take Holy Communion.
The joyous ceremony is nevertheless shadowed by a deeper fracture within the global Eritrean Orthodox Church. This division can be traced back to 2007, when the Eritrean government controversially removed Patriarch Abunne Antonius, a revered spiritual leader known for resisting state interference. His replacement, installed with government backing, sparked a global rift between those who remained loyal to Antonius and those who accepted the new state-aligned hierarchy. Bishop Macarius, a steadfast ally of the deposed Patriarch Abunne Antonius.
They thought that me, Tobias Mann, one can't be servant for two, either I have to be they or the God. I did nothing wrong to them, but I said, you government don't interfere to our administration.
Do you think there's any hope of reconciliation between you and the government of Eritrea?
It is easy. He has to give the power to the people and the people to elect what they want.
What about the diaspora? What would reconcile the diaspora?
Well, the diaspora, see, we are not divided in faith. They want to speak Amharic. We said no. The apostles, they want to speak the people in their own language. The language of the apostle was Hebrew, Aramaic. The church has to speak the language of the people. That is the problem.
for the more than 24,000 Eritrean-born residents in the UK, many of whom arrived as asylum seekers fleeing indefinite national service and political repression. Faith is more than a ritual. It's a lifeline to memory of home, of loss, and of resilience.
My name is Samhar Mebrahtu.
Why did you leave Eritrea?
My dad is a soldier. He died. My brother, my mom, single mom, she growing us for 20-something years. So I couldn't live there because of the politics. Eritrea is not for the people of Eritrea. Eritrea is for the dictatorship only and for their family. That's why I leave my country.
Do you hope to go back home one day?
I pray for that all the time. Half of my family is in back home. I never saw them for 15 years.
Are you worried about them?
Yes, I am, because they're suffering a lot. Many life is gone. Many life is in jail. I never sleep. Every night I'm praying, I'm crying about my family and about all my Eritrean people.
The ordination of Johannes stands as a quiet act of defiance and of hope. He told me why this ordination is important to the community.
Honestly, I'm not only as a priest praying in the church, I have a mission also to lead for justice and freedom of my community. The other priests in Manchester or Great Britain, they didn't accept our church, my church, because of the division. So because of that issue, we invite from Germany. Now, Medhane Alam Church, they have own priest from today.
So you will preside over the ceremonies?
Yeah. I lead in myself from next Sunday.
And so now, what's the next step now that you've been ordained?
My next step, try to call for reconciliation from the Manchester Church, the Great Britain Church, and also Europe-American churches, also with the Eritrean bishops. This is my desire, but God knows.
The ordination of Father Johannes marks a new chapter for the Eritrean Orthodox believers in this Manchester church. It is a moment of spiritual renewal after years of quiet perseverance.
That report from Baraatu Ibrahim. It's 7:30, still to come this morning. The Supreme Court ruled this week that Northern Ireland's Christian-focused RE curriculum is unlawful. So what happens next there? And could that ruling have implications for religious education in schools across the UK? That's ahead on today's Sunday.
The hills are alive with the sound of music.
You really had a wonderful life. Don't you see what a mistake it would be to throw it away?
Get me back! I don't care what happens to me! I want to live again!
The Sound of Music and It's a Wonderful Life, two of the most beloved films of all time. But did you know they have a rather unexpected superfan?
My four favourite films. It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart from 1946. The Sound of Music from 1965 with Julie Andrews. Ordinary People, the year was 1980. The stars were Donald Sutherland and Mary Tyler Moore. La Vita Bella, 1997, Roberto Benigni.
Yes, Pope Leo has revealed his top four favourite films ahead of an event at the Vatican where he welcomes some Hollywood A-listers, including Cate Blanchett, Viggo Mortensen and Monica Bellucci. And he encouraged actors and directors to see themselves as pilgrims of the imagination with a vocation to bring light, meaning and hope to the world. It's not the first time the Catholic Church has stepped into the world of cinema, though this pope maybe the closest the Vatican has ever come to a true cinephile. To help us make sense of the Pope's passion for cinema, we turn to Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic of the New York Times, formerly a critic with Christianity Today.
When someone tells you their favourite films, you're kind of learning what they value or what they love and what makes them tick. And so I think, you know, when you look at Pope Leo's list, you're seeing It's a Wonderful Life, The Sound of Music. These are movies about people going through difficult times and also finding love and hope in the midst of those difficult times. That's also what Life is Beautiful is about. And then Ordinary People is, you know, a drama about people experiencing grief in a family. So you kind of see similar themes there, which is like hope and redemption, family, and also grief not being something that's easy to deal with, but something that you find hope and faith in one another. So there's really a theme of community there.
Did that list surprise you in any way? You know, you can see these lists out on the internet of the most popular Catholic movies of all time, for example, and Ordinary People wouldn't be on those lists typically.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not a terribly Catholic list, but I will say if I had asked my, you know, Catholic grandfather what some of his favorite movies are, I would say he probably would pick some of these. So yes, that didn't surprise me too much. It feels like, you know, typical perhaps in that way. But they certainly feel like, you know, these are movies of a man like Pope Leo, of his age range, right? And of someone who came up the way that he did.
And also a very American list.
Very much an American list. Yeah, these are three very American movies, and one that maybe isn't, but is certainly an Oscar winner and one that, you know, most Americans are familiar with.
Are you surprised he didn't go for two popes?
I mean, maybe that one strikes a little close to home, but there have been so many movies about his predecessor. Francis was a bit of a Hollywood star in some ways, so, you know, I guess we'll see if Leo becomes one too.
What about the connection between the Vatican and Hollywood? Obviously, it's an event at the Vatican itself, but there's a long connection, isn't there, between the church and cinema in various parts of the world, including the United States, not least in the area of censorship or guidance, moral guidance.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, certainly in Hollywood, you know, dating back all the way to before the world wars, even, there was a connection between clergy, Catholic clergy, Protestant, Jewish, who would come in, you know, and talk to Hollywood executives, talk to filmmakers, kind of provide moral guidance, and also be involved with efforts that the studios brought together in order to, we might say, self-censorship, you know, kind of guide what kind of content they would put on the screens. This is what led to the production code, which guided content from the 30s to the late 60s in the US, eventually giving way to the MPAA production code that we use here today. You know, that was mainly guided by clergy, and that, you know, was sort of helping people decide what was morally acceptable to see in a movie theater. And Catholic priests were a big part of that. So a lot of what you see in films from that era coming out of Hollywood are a direct result of guidance from the Catholic Church.
I suppose some people might wonder if the Pope is a little too optimistic about Hollywood, talking about pilgrims of the imagination and a vocation to bring hope. It's a business, ultimately, isn't it?
Certainly it is a business, but I do think there is something that's always been very idealistic about the movie business. It's always been walking a funny tightrope between technology on the one side and artistry on the other, between, you know, business and inspiration. And a lot of people who get into the movie business are not there because they want to make a lot of money. They're there because they want to make art. It might give way to the money side eventually, but there's sort of always been a balancing act between the two. And it's nice to see, you know, the Pope, who's really in the art business or the inspiration business more than the money business at the end of the day, tapping into that and tapping into what I think drives a lot of the artists towards the business, even if eventually, you know, the financial considerations always kick in. And right now, the movie business is really struggling. A lot of people, maybe not the movie stars, but a lot of people who just do the day in, day out work of making movies are really struggling to make a living for a lot of the reasons that the Pope has talked about, things like AI and labor considerations. So it makes a lot of sense to me that this is something that he thinks he needs to talk about.
Interesting also, Alyssa, that the Pope has expressed concerns about the decline in cinema spaces, the theatres themselves. Again, that may say something about his own moral convictions, for example, around community.
I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people do talk about movie theaters in the same phrases and ideas as they do talk about churches. You know, sometimes people call a movie theater a cathedral of cinema. And I think that's because for a lot of people, they fill a similar gap. You know, it's a place that we come together. We experience something together that's bigger than us. We feel connected to something that goes beyond our little lives. And movie theaters as collective public spaces are fading in the same way that for a lot of people, you know, churches might have been a place where they met together in the past, and those are fading. And so there is a fear, you know, that as those public spaces for community fade, that we're losing something very vital about our culture. And so it makes sense to me that that's something he would be concerned about.
Alyssa Wilkinson from The New York Times on Pope Leo at the movies. The Supreme Court ruled on Wednesday that Northern Ireland's Christian-focused RE curriculum is unlawful. Since then, churches, politicians and schools there have been trying to make sense of the possible implications of that ruling, both for RE teaching and for the place of religion in schools more generally. Robbie Meredith is BBC Northern Ireland's education correspondent. Good morning, Robbie. Good to have you with us.
Morning, William.
Just briefly, take us to the case, first of all, that was brought to the courts that eventually led to the Supreme Court judgment.
Yeah, William, this started with a father and daughter here in Northern Ireland. Now, they challenged the legality of the religious education she was being taught in school and also the collective worship in her primary school assemblies, effectively. Should say the daughter, her parents and the school are all anonymised in all court proceedings. But we know that she was aged between 4 and 7 when this started. She'll be older now. The family were a non-religious family. They noticed she was saying prayers before meals at home and also asking them questions about God. They in turn asked her why, and she told them she was doing basically what she'd been taught at school. So they queried it with the school, but eventually what happened was that the whole thing ended up in the High Court here in Belfast because the family challenged the religious education and collective worship in court, saying it breached their right to freedom of thought and conscience under the European Convention of Human Rights. And there is quite a legal history to this. The High Court in Belfast in 2022 found in the family's favour. That was subsequently overturned by the Court of Appeal. But this week it ended up in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court effectively reinstated that original High Court judgment, which found that the family's rights had been breached by the RE and the collective worship that was going on in the child's school.
So let's come to the judgment itself at the Supreme Court, Robbie. What does it say? And just as importantly, what does it not say?
Yeah, let's start with the not say, William, because I think that is the most straightforward thing. This judgment is not about making the school system here secular. The judges are quite clear on that. It's also not about ending religious education. In the judgment, and here I'm paraphrasing a bit, it does say that Christianity is going to remain an important religion in Northern Ireland. That's not going to change. It's also going to be the religion taught most in religious education here as well. But what the judgment does say is that the core RE syllabus doesn't teach religion in an objective, critical or pluralistic manner. Instead, it says the child was taught religious, how the child was taught religious education amounted to indoctrination. Therefore, the family's rights to freedom of thought and freedom of conscience had been breached. And I think from that judgment, there will be many consequences, both for how religious education is taught in Northern Ireland, but also some of those other cultural factors, if you like, assemblies and so on, that involve Christianity in schools here.
Or even indeed, and we'll get to this in a moment, how the curriculum itself is put together, because Northern Ireland, unlike other parts of the UK, has given the authorship role of the core curriculum to the four main churches there. Just finally, Robbie, reactions. How's the education system and the church system reacting to all of that?
Well, the churches have been fairly relaxed about it so far, William. They've been quite measured. They accept there is a need for revision of the religious education curriculum. It hasn't changed for quite a long time, I think a couple of decades. So they accept it's going to have to be rewritten. They want to play a role in that. So they accept changes will have to come. Politicians have also been reacting to that. You can imagine some are quite concerned that this is an erosion of Christianity, both in our school system and in society more widely. Interestingly, the Education Minister, Paul Given, who's normally quite media-friendly, he hasn't commented yet. I think he's got a lot to weigh up. And what will be important ultimately is the guidance that his department gives to schools here about what they can and can't do on the basis of this judgment.
Robbie, thanks very much. BBC Northern Ireland's education correspondent Robbie Meredith there. Fiona Moss is with us, education and programmes manager with Cullum St Gabriel's Trust, which has championed changes in England's national curriculum, the UK's national curriculum, to embed teaching of religion. Welcome, Fiona.
Good morning.
Just generally, how important do you think this judgment is?
I think it's a really important judgment. It is, as you've said, viewed very positively by the majority in Northern Ireland. And that move to an objective, critical and plural RE, I think, is essential in the world today. Our charity has been supporting a project at Queen's University with James Nelson and Rebecca Loder. And they've been looking into exactly this. And they've been talking, they did a population survey, they talked to teachers, and there's a real attitude for change. So I think what's happened in the judgment is actually catching up with where people are. And what those people that they looked at in that study that launches in early December talked about was the essential nature of inclusivity, that there are diverse beliefs and worldviews represented in Northern Ireland, and they weren't being reflected in the RE curriculum.
And so, of course, it's a very religious society historically, and I think I'm right in saying it's the only part of the UK where the main churches have this rather monopoly role of authoring the core curriculum just amongst themselves within that system. Do you think there might be implications for the rest of the UK?
I think it's interesting. The rest of the UK are on their own journey with reviewing RE. Wales, a couple of years ago, it's religion, values and ethics, of course, in Wales. And they have picked up on this objective, critical and plural language. So they've already reviewed their curriculum. Interestingly, they've removed the right of withdrawal from parents, because I know that came up in the judgment. In Scotland and England, they're actually right in the midst of reviewing their whole curriculum. And in both RE or RME, Religious and Moral Education in Scotland, are part of that review. So there's a 10-year review going on in Scotland. In England, it's been part of the Curriculum and Assessment Review. And interestingly, this judgment comes at a very good time because in England, the community are now have been asked by the government to review what's going to go into any RE curriculum if it's going to go into the national curriculum. Now, in England, as you rightly point out, it's not RE is not organised in the same way as in Northern Ireland. And actually, we have groups from lots of different religious and non-religious worldviews supporting other educational professionals to put curricula together. But I think this idea of objective, critical and plural is really important. It's going to help us create a curriculum that is... Now,
and sorry, just to break in the last 20 seconds, a key part of this judgment is the Supreme Court saying if your RE teaching is not objective, critical and pluralistic, it is ipso facto indoctrination. That's a key line in this statement.
It absolutely is. And of course, no teacher wants to be indoctrinating a child.
Of course.
We want children to be interpreting. We want them to be able to see the rich diversity. We want them to be able to understand what people believe and what difference it makes to how they live.
Fiona?
And that's going to help people answer big questions.
Thank you very much, Fiona Moss. And now that we know for sure, from the Supreme Court at least, that singing hymns in school is indeed lawful. It's legal. You can keep doing that. We can talk about the nation's favourite school hymn. The UK's favourite school hymn will be revealed today as the winner of a public poll is announced on Songs of Praise this afternoon as part of the big school assembly sing-along. Could it be one of these bangers?
Of the whole world, in his hands, of the whole wide world, in his hands, of the whole world, in his
That is James B. Partridge and the audience singing Give Me Oil in My Lamp, and he's got the whole world in his hands. You can watch it all on Songs of Praise at 1:15 today on BBC One. In the lead up to the result of the poll, Radio 4 Extra's Daily Service has been exploring the nostalgia and the spiritual resonance of singing hymns in schools. Here are some students from Didsbury Church of England Primary School in Manchester.
These songs are really enjoyable because they help you forget about your worries and you're just singing and just focusing on that.
They always make me feel warm on the inside and out.
Brings me joy.
It brings you joy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they teach us, like, when we feel a bit down and we don't really like something, they teach us to, like, warm up and feel better and be grateful that everyone's around us.
Those kids are fantastic, aren't they? You can hear all of those programmes on BBC Sounds. They're presented by Becky Silver, who's a songwriter of contemporary songs for schools and a former teacher. Welcome, Becky.
Thank you so much, William.
Dig down into this for us, would you? What kind of songs work well in the school setting?
Well, I think we have to recognise that we live in a very different world from the 80s and 90s, when a lot of those songs which we've been listening to on that list of favourite assembly songs come from. So, you know, you've been talking already on your programme about society being very diverse, a mix of faiths and no faith. So I think it's really important that contemporary songs, they're not about imposing faith, but on opening up the possibility of faith to young people, enabling them to ask questions about the world, to think about the mystery of life, and providing a spiritual place for life, that spiritual life to grow and flourish. So we when we're writing our songs at Pop UK, we want to point out the wonder of the world. You know, it's not often in life we stop to look at the wonder of the world, to be amazed by the world, to celebrate hope and encourage joy, give children an opportunity to express their thanks and give them the kind of vocabulary to express those early ideas of faith.
But we still love the old ones. I mean, I'm getting lots of emails into the programme, and one of the most common suggestion here is Wide, Wide as the Ocean. Do you remember that one? Wide, Wide as the Ocean.
I do, although I have to say, William, my days at school were before then. I remember songs like Onward Christian Soldiers, When a Knight Won His Spurs, quite military songs, actually, for young girl at primary school. But I also remember Dear Lord and Father of Mankind, which was a classic, and really a song about a relationship with God as well, which I think more than just kind of going out and proving ourselves in the service of God.
But Becky, I think with Wide, Wide as the Ocean, one of the fun things about that song, as I remember as a kid, is the actions that accompanied the song. You'd reach your arms out to say it was wide. I mean, you can sing it with me, right? Wide, wide as the ocean.
Right.
What is the next line? High as the heavens above. Deep is the deep blue sea is my Saviour's love. And you get the kids to action that out in the assembly. You remember it because you've dramatised the singing.
That's right, indeed. And they absolutely enjoy that. And I think it's a really important skill to be able to match the music to the words so that the music actually kind of underlines, underscores the message of the song. Using actions, we use images as well so that children who maybe have send issues can engage with visual images that we put up on the videos with the songs on. So there are lots of ways of engaging children's attention and helping them to really enjoy being part of the singing. We use contemporary tunes. So my husband, who's the musician, I do the lyrics, he has a very keen ear for contemporary pop, and he's always listening to what are young people listening to. They don't want to sing twee songs. They love their pop songs.
Yeah.
So it's using that, but also bringing in really strong melodies that, as you say, will stay with them for life.
What kind of pop songs are you using?
Well, I mean, we write them, so they're not...
But they're inspired by...
But they're inspired by, so you might think of Ariana Grande or, you know, other contemporary singers, and you just think, you listen in to their style and you think, what is it that they're doing with their music that young people enjoy? Interesting to look at the changing length of songs. You know, they love swing songs that have got a real beat to them. Some of the reluctant singers love taking part in a rap, so we insert, you know, at the moment, one of our Christmas songs has a rap for the shepherds, you know, we are the shepherds and we are on a mission, we are not messing, you know, and young boys love that, even if they don't don't particularly want to get involved with singing. So it's just finding a way to encourage them to engage with songs, and we absolutely believe they stay with them through life.
There's no question about that, just from the emails coming in and our own story. These are some of the moments that really just live with you, that you remember your childhood, often with the soundtrack of these songs and hymns.
Yes, absolutely. And I think when we did our daily service programs, you know, we were talking to people who would say that some of the songs have traveled with them through life. They've been like companions through life. And that's very important, that those things remain stable through the ups and downs. They're the kind of pillars that you can hold on to. You can go back, you can sing them at times when, you know, you don't feel able to, maybe to pray or express faith in other ways. But those songs are there to give you something that you hold on to. I think, you know, those James Partridge songs at Glastow.
They're amazing. Yeah.
Oh, the way that's all coming back.
Becky, I've only got 10 seconds. Name your favourite hymn for us, your favourite children's hymn.
My favourite children's hymn, well, one that's appeared on
the
list.
Come on.
It's Shine, Jesus, Shine.
Because Shine, Jesus, Shine.
Prayer for our country.
Thank you, Becky. Thank you very much. That's it from us. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Sunday was produced by Katie Davis and Baraatu Ibrahim. Now the garden historian and presenter of Gardener's World, Advili Richmond, makes the Radio 4 appeal on behalf of Village Water.
That's the sound of children playing at their school in rural Mozambique. They're happy and healthy. But until recently, life was very different. Their only source of water was an unprotected well, which made them prone to diseases. And they're not the only ones. Thousands of children across the region struggle to access safe water. Take 17-year-old Lucas and his 15-year-old sister, Angelina. 3 years ago, their school only had 3 pit toilets for 2,000 children without sinks or sanitation to help girls and female teachers manage their periods. In the hot season, the well would run dry, leaving the school and local area with no water at all. Tired, thirsty and unable to wash, Lucas struggled to focus. Every day, he'd walk Angelina home during their break to use their family's pit toilet. But without water, they couldn't wash their hands after using the toilet. They were frequently sick and unable to keep up with schoolwork. Lucas also missed lessons to help his mother find firewood and fetch water from the river. But with 7 children, the family sometimes drank and washed in brown murky water, as they didn't always have time to boil it. Everything changed when the charity Village Water installed a solar-powered water system at the school, along with private showers, flushing toilets and safe drinking water. Now Lucas and Angelina can wash their hands and drink safe water. They're happy, focus on schoolwork and are one step nearer their dreams of becoming teachers. Their mother can also use the new facilities and now has time to sell maize to make money to buy school books and uniforms. I grew up in rural Zimbabwe and remember fetching water from the river with my aunts. That's why I agreed to become an ambassador for Village Water. In rural Mozambique, nearly half of all people still lack access to basic, safe water. And unsafe water kills thousands of children each year. £25 could enable the charity to bring safe water to a child at their home and school. To donate, please search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144 or write a cheque to Village Water and send it to Free Post BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Please write Village Water on the back of your envelope. Thank you so much.
Advili Richmond, that number again is 0800 404 8144. The calls are free from landlines and from mobiles, and you can find all the details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Let's get a weather update now. Here's Simon King.
Neil, thank you so much indeed. Good morning. We've had some pretty wet weather this morning with a big area of low pressure moving its way in across northern parts of the UK and associated weather front bringing that rain moving from west to east across many parts. Now, for the Midlands, eastern and southeastern England, we've still got some heavy rain around this morning. But it is continuing to move eastward, and quite quickly, I think, we'll see that clearing away, and we're going to be left with some largely sunny weather throughout this afternoon, certainly. Quite breezy, and temperatures will get to about 9 to 11 degrees. In southwest England and Wales, well, the rain is pretty much clear, but we've got some showers now moving in across Wales and southwest England, along with quite a brisk west or northwesterly wind. We could see gusts of wind of 40, 50 miles an hour, particularly around coastal areas today. There will be some sunny spells, but a continuation of showers coming in from the west with highs of about 7 to 11 Celsius. Now, across northern England, still that wet weather, particularly towards eastern areas of northern England. That's clearing away. We may see a bit of sunshine for time, but the cloud will build up again and there'll be some frequent showery rain, I think, for much of the afternoon. Highs of 6 to 8 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, central and southern Scotland, this is where the area of low pressure is moving through, so it's going to stay really quite unsettled through the day. The wind, not so much of an issue, but there will be that rain continuing, I think, at times. Some heavy showers into Northern Ireland, highs of 5 to 8 Celsius. But for Northern Scotland, here it's going to be a little bit drier. There'll be some sunny spells, but showers coming in, especially towards northeastern areas on that southeasterly wind, and maximum temperatures in Northern Scotland getting to about 6 or 7 Celsius. Neil, back to you.
Thanks, Simon King, with the weather. Now let's hear from Paddy O'Connell, who is here to tell us about Broadcasting House. Good morning, Paddy.
Good morning, Neil, and hello, good morning to you. There are talks in Geneva today on Donald Trump's Land for Peace deal for Ukraine. Steve Rosenberg and Jeremy Bowen lead our live coverage on Radio 4 as the map of Europe is up for grabs. Amid the rollercoaster of the Ashes, cricketers in Suffolk hope to award their own Ashes trophy after arsonists torched their pavilion. There have been some big underdog victories for Scotland and Ireland, which we'll talk about too. We're on Nature Watch in the Lake District National Park, and we hear how artificial intelligence is boosting life for blind people, as we'll be joined by the campaigning comic Chris McCausland, and the editor promises no budget speculation.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 23rd of November. Good morning, this is Jane Steele. Talks about a peace deal for Ukraine are moving to Geneva after the UK and other allies said the White House proposals needed work. Regulated rail fares in England are to be frozen from next year for the first time in three decades. The Chancellor is expected to announce more funding in the budget to encourage the use of electric cars. Delegations from Ukraine and the US, as well as European security chiefs, will meet in Geneva later today to discuss President Trump's controversial 28-point plan to end the war with Russia. The proposals would see Kyiv hand territory to Moscow and place limits on the size of Ukraine's armed forces. The US president had set President Zelensky a deadline of Thursday to accept the draft deal, but has now appeared to suggest there's room for manoeuvre. Here's our World News correspondent Joe Inwood.
As he boarded his helicopter at the White House, President Trump was asked, "Is this your final offer to Ukraine?" His answer, "No, not right now," will have given a glimmer of hope to Ukraine and its supporters and suggested that today's talks could bear fruit. For Kyiv, hope has been in short supply ever since details emerged of a peace plan widely seen as one-sided in Russia's favour. As well as top Ukrainian and US officials, European national security advisers will be taking part in today's talks, hoping to get rid of any territorial concessions or limits on Ukraine's armed forces. In a joint statement yesterday, the leaders of the UK, EU, Japan and Canada said the 28-point plan required additional work. In diplomatic terms, a stinging criticism.
The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who's heading to the Geneva talks, has insisted the White House Ukraine plan was drawn up by the US. He was responding to claims from three senators who said they'd been told earlier by Mr. Rubio that it was a Russian wish list. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman reports from Washington.
The three senators say they spoke to Secretary Rubio on the phone on his way to Geneva, having asked him to clarify how the 28-point peace plan emerged. One of them, Mike Rounds, a Republican who sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee, said they were concerned that the leaked document looked Russian in nature, including even the way it had been written. The senators say Mr. Rubio told them it was not, in fact, an American proposal, but a Russian plan leaked by the Russian side, and that the Ukrainians would be able to respond to it and negotiate. This contradicts the position of the White House, which said this week the plan was endorsed by Mr. Trump, having been drawn up by his officials.
The COP30 UN climate summit in Brazil has closed. A final deal came hours after the official deadline and was judged by many to be nowhere near ambitious enough. There was a promise of more funding to help poorer nations, but no explicit mention of the fossil fuels that drive global warming. All schools in the state of Niger in Nigeria have been ordered to close following a mass kidnapping. More than 300 children and staff were abducted from a Catholic boarding school on Friday. It thought the unidentified kidnappers are likely to be part of a criminal gang seeking ransoms. Some train fares in England are set to be frozen next year for the first time in decades as part of broader government plans to transfer rail services back into public ownership. The freeze until March 2027 will apply to regulated fares, which include season tickets and off-peak returns. The Transport Secretary Haider Alexander said the decision meant commuters would be able to keep more of their hard-earned cash.
If you're spending thousands of pounds on a season ticket to commute to work, actually, it makes a really big difference not to see your fares going up by hundreds of pounds. And so they are significant savings for people. We think that's the right thing to do to help people with the cost of living. And I think it's a big moment, given that rail fares haven't been frozen for the last 30 years.
The Chancellor is expected to use her upcoming budget to announce more than £1 billion in funding for a scheme encouraging the use of electric cars. The Electric Car Grant Scheme, which provides a discount of nearly £4,000 on eligible vehicles, will also be extended by an extra year. Here's our political correspondent, Georgia Roberts.
This scheme started in July as part of the move towards zero-emission vehicles. The government claims it's helped 35,000 switch to electric vehicles. Some early research, however, suggests there's little indication the scheme has attracted entirely new buyers. There'll also be money to create more charging points and a consultation on helping people without driveways to charge their cars. The cost of public electric vehicle charging, which has risen in recent years, will also be looked at. However, it's also possible that electric car owners could face a new tax elsewhere in the budget, potentially in the form of a paper mile charge from 2028. And the Chancellor's being urged not to raise taxes on drivers overall.
A House of Lords committee is warning that autistic people in England still face unacceptable inequalities, 16 years on from the passing of the Autism Act. In a new report, peers say the disparities are holding back autistic people from living fulfilling lives, and they urge the government to deliver real and lasting change. Graham Satchell reports.
The peers examined life for autistic people in England from education and employment to life expectancy. They acknowledged that the 2009 Autism Act was a step forward in recognising the neurodiversity, but said successive governments had failed to deliver real change. More than 200,000 people are waiting for an autism assessment. Autistic children, the report says, often don't enjoy school, and just 30% of autistic adults are in work. The committees urge the government to improve initial assessment times, provide lifelong support, and to incentivise employers to help more autistic people thrive in work. A Department of Health spokesman said the government was committed to improving the lives of autistic people, ensuring they received high-quality, empathetic and dignified care.
Formula One, Red Bull's Max Verstappen has won the Las Vegas Grand Prix. The British McLaren driver Lando Norris came second, picking up valuable points to extend his lead in the Drivers' Championship. A gold pocket watch recovered from a passenger who drowned during the sinking of the Titanic has sold for almost £1.8 million at an auction at Devizes in Wiltshire. The watch belonged to the American businessman Isidore Strauss, who died along with his wife Ida when they refused a place in a lifeboat. That's the news. Now for a look at the Sunday papers, many of which focus on answers the Prime Minister gave to reporters at the G20 summit asking about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. The Mail on Sunday says Sir Keir Starmer has piled pressure on the former prince to testify to the US Congress about what he knew about Jeffrey Epstein. The former Duke of York has so far ignored requests by American politicians to come forward with any information. Sir Keir said it was ultimately up to Andrew, but that anybody with information about what he called these kind of cases should give evidence. The paper claims it has an exclusive, but the story features on the front of several other papers. The Sunday People says Sir Keir refused to comment on the case of the former prince directly, but said, if you have relevant information, you should be prepared to share it. The Sunday Times and Sunday Telegraph both point out that Congress cannot force foreign nationals to appear before its committees. England's dramatic loss from a position of strength in cricket's first Ashes test in Australia dominates the sports pages. Writing in the Sunday Telegraph, the former England batsman Sir Geoffrey Boycott says, I can't take stupid England seriously, highlighting what he calls reckless batting and a refusal to listen to criticism. In the Sunday Times, which devotes six pages to the defeat, the former England captain Mike Atherton says the loss was one of the most discouraging under the current leadership of Ben Stokes and the coach Brendan McCullum. The Observer describes England players as having to peel themselves off the pitch in a state of disbelief they had surrendered such a strong position. Ahead of her budget on Wednesday, the Sunday Times says the Chancellor is preparing to spend £3 billion to end the two-child benefit cap. But it reports she has also insisted the government will make another attempt to reform welfare. The Sunday Telegraph says the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has accused Rachel Reeves of cowardice for refusing to admit she will raise taxes by freezing thresholds for another 2 years. The paper's editorial says all the signs are pointing to a brutal assault on Middle England in the budget, squeezing people in work to pay for those on benefits. The Chancellor herself tells the Sunday Mirror that she's going to tackle the cost of living crisis. She says working families will be at the front of her mind on Wednesday. The Sunday Telegraph says a move by a Chinese company to take over Thames Water could be blocked. It reports that the government has been urged not to let CK Infrastructure take a controlling stake in the huge water company, which services 16 million customers across London and the South East and is more than £20 billion in debt. One human rights campaigner warned such a takeover could literally allow China to switch off the taps. Finally, the Daily Express reports that the RAF is considering allowing overweight pilots to use weight loss drugs. The paper notes fighter pilots face strict limits on their weight so they can safely eject from aircraft. I'll look at the Sunday papers.
Many thanks, Jane Steele. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 8:10 and time now for Sunday worship.
Good morning and welcome to the Diocese of Leeds. I'm Father Mark Pitson, chaplain to the Diocesan Youth Service. We're at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in central Bradford on the Feast of Christ the King, which the Catholic Church also celebrates as an annual National Youth Sunday. And it's a triple celebration, as during this holy year of hope throughout the Catholic Church, this weekend also marks the Jubilee of Choirs. Our music is from the young people of our Bradford Catholic Youth Choir, who lead us now in the hymn, Crown Him with Many Crowns. since it was first instituted just 100 years ago by Pope Pius XI, Catholics have celebrated this solemnity of our Lord Jesus Christ, King of the universe, on the last Sunday of November. In 1925, the world was still suffering the after effects of the Great War. It was a time of growing nationalism and secularism, which would eventually bring the world to the brink of another terrible war. In Italy and Germany, fascism was on the rise. In our own country, the excesses of the hedonistic Bright Young Thing and newly rich self-made millionaires made front page news. But the gap between rich and poor could not have been wider. Faced with this unequal society of extremes, the Church's response was to institute a feast, reminding us that it is God in Jesus Christ who is the supreme authority and ruler of all creation. His kingdom is not one of short-lived worldly wealth and power. He is a servant king whose reign is eternal, and he rules with justice, compassion, love, and mercy for all. Let us now call to mind the times when we ourselves have been distracted by worldly things and have not loved him and our fellow men and women as we should, as we ask the Lord to have mercy on us. Let us pray. Almighty, ever-living God, whose will is to restore all things in your beloved Son, the King of the universe, grant, we pray, that the whole creation, set free from slavery, may render your majesty service and ceaselessly proclaim your praise. Through our Lord Jesus Christ, your Son, who lives and reigns with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit, God, for ever and ever. Amen. The acknowledgement that Christ is King does not, of course, mean that we should not respect the leadership of a benign earthly monarch or temporal ruler. However, there have been saints and martyrs throughout the ages who have prioritized worshiping Christ the King over some earthly rulers or government's wishes, and have paid for it with their lives. The famous quotation from St. Thomas More, as King Henry VIII sent him to his martyrdom, was, "I am the king's good servant, but God's first." Christ's kingship was misunderstood by many, from King Herod, who, fearing that the king of the Jews had come to topple him from his throne, plotted to kill the infant Jesus, to Judas and his fellow revolutionaries, who believe that a king should lead an army against Roman oppression. And in the readings of today from the Gospel of St. Luke, while most mocked Jesus, crucified like a common criminal, one repentant sinner recognized his majesty, threw himself on the Lord's mercy, and received his just reward.
At that time, the rulers scoffed at Jesus, saying, "He saved others, let him save himself if he is the Christ of God, his chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." There was also an inscription over him, "This is the King of the Jews." One of the criminals who were hanged there railed at Jesus, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And indeed we justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." And he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And he said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." Message to members of the early church was that not only is Christ our King and Creator, through his sacrifice on the cross, he has given us a share in his kingdom too. This inheritance isn't by virtue of race, nationality, intellect, or social standing. It is open to all who are baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. We are all called to serve humbly, with a responsibility to care for others and to be custodians of God's creation. The Church is there for all people who follow and worship Christ as the way, the truth, and the life, through the faith which comes to us directly from his apostles.
A reading from the letter of St. Paul to the Colossians. Brothers and sisters, let us give thanks to the Father, who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in light. He has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invincible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones of dominions or rulers or authorities. All things are created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of the cross. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
In 2021, the Feast of Christ the King has also been celebrated in the Diocese of the Catholic Church as National Youth Sunday. Here in the Diocese of Leeds, we recognise the leadership potential of our young people. They are not just the future, but the now of the Church. The Bishop has commissioned a leadership group of 13 to 18-year-olds to assist him with the decisions, events, and all matters concerning our young people. They're called the 12, and Becca, who is a student at St. Bede's and St. Joseph's Catholic College here in Bradford, is a member.
It may seem difficult to declare Christ as King in today's world. Young people might worry about being judged or laughed at, but we should constantly remind ourselves that our reward in heaven is far greater than anything in this world, and ask God for the courage always to proclaim Christ as King. There are countless examples of young saints who have done this and more for God and for others, so we can use their lives as examples. A century ago, the 14-year-old Mexican saint José Luis Sánchez del Río went to his martyrdom declaring, "Viva Cristo Rey, long live Christ the King." Although we hope never to be put to such a test, we can be inspired by his faith and courage. We may need that inspiration if we're mocked or laughed at for following Christ. And even if our faith is not challenged by other people, there are many bad influences and distractions in social media that can tempt us away from Christ. My favourite young saint is St. Carlo Acutis, who was canonised earlier this year. He was just 15 when he died of leukaemia in 2006. In his short life, he displayed a devotion to the Eucharist and used his computer skills to create a website documenting Eucharistic miracles. Following in the footsteps of St. Carlo Acutis, we too can use our talents to serve God and our neighbour. And rather than being consumed by technologies and social media, we can use them as tools to spread the good news of the gospel. Inspired by this Jubilee year of hope, it's my hope that more young people find the faith and courage to declare Christ as King, taking leadership roles in the church and, in the words of the Jubilee hymn, carrying the flame of hope to all people.
Thank you.
There is a patron saint for almost every activity, and music is no exception. Every year on the 22nd of November, we honour Saint Cecilia, the patron saint of music. And it is for this reason that in this holy year of Jubilee, this weekend has been designated the Jubilee of Choirs. Our music this morning is led by the Bradford Catholic Youth Choir. These young people have come through our Diocese of Leeds school singing programme. Thousands of children of all faiths and none who attend our Catholic schools throughout Yorkshire experience the many social, health, cultural and academic benefits of learning music and the sheer joy of singing together. Before going to university, Kirsten Zaletta was a member of our Leeds Cathedral Choir.
Not much is known about St. Cecilia, but we do know she existed in 2nd century Rome, that she converted her pagan husband to Christianity, and that the couple suffered martyrdom for love of Christ the King, putting his worship before the wishes of the Roman governor. Described as singing to God in her heart, those of us who love to sing can identify with St. Cecilia and understand her need to rejoice beyond mere speech. That is why I chose her as my confirmation saint. St. Augustine is said to have written that those who sing well pray twice, a reminder for us to sing not only with our lips, but also with our lives. We profess our faith through speech, but singing adds the elements of love and joy. Worshipping in song involves both the intellectual and the physical, words, melodies, and harmonies blending to engage the listener, guiding them beyond deep emotion and into faith. In fact, the word worship comes from the idea of acknowledging the worth of something or someone. And who could be more worthy of our honor and reverence than our Lord Jesus Christ, the King? In our school, cathedral, and parish choirs, we don't just sing in English and in Latin, but also in some of the more than 40 languages which are spoken in our communities. Singing with other faithful friends creates a sense of belonging, a call of prayerful service to God, using the gifts he has given to us. Along with our parents, siblings, friends, choir chaperones, and choral directors, we feel we belong to an extended family of a parish, cathedral, and diocese, a community of the Universal Catholic Church, bound together by faith, joy, and love expressed through music.
Oh,
Let us pray. For the church, for all God's faithful, and for people of goodwill throughout the world, may the praises of Christ the King be sung with our lips, in our hearts, and in our lives. Lord, hear us.
Lord, graciously hear us.
We pray for King Charles and Queen Camilla, for His Holiness Pope Leo, and for all who hold positions of leadership, locally, nationally, and internationally, that, motivated by love and service, they may govern wisely, with humility and with compassion, for those whose lives are in their care. We pray that they may always have the courage to hold fast to the truth. Lord, hear us.
Lord, graciously hear us.
We pray for people who are ill in body, mind, or spirit, especially those who are lonely, afraid, living under tyranny, or being persecuted for their beliefs, that God's love may strengthen them. We pray too for all who are mourning loved ones and for all who have died, especially victims of violence and war, that they may now know eternal peace and rest with Christ, who has conquered sin and death. Lord, hear us.
Lord, graciously hear us.
And let us pray for the coming of God's kingdom in the words Jesus taught us. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
From the 8th century until the Reformation, the praises of Christ the King, known in Latin as the Laudes Regi, were sung at a monarch's coronation as a reminder that his temporal power was secondary to that of Christ the King of Kings. Christus vincit, he conquers. Christus regnat, he reigns. Christus imperat, Christ rules and commands. Thank you for joining us this morning and sharing in our worship of Jesus Christ, King of the universe. And may the blessing of Almighty God, the Father,
the Son, and the Holy Spirit come down on you and remain with you forever.
Amen.
William Harris flourish for an occasion, ending today's Sunday worship, which came from St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Bradford. The service was led by Father Mark Pitson. Craig Perkinton and Adam Whitmore conducted the Bradford Youth Choir, accompanied by organist Benjamin Newlove. The producer was Carmel Lunigan. Next week, Sunday worship begins a seasonal series, Advent Authors. The service will come live on St. Andrew's Day from St. Salvator's Chapel in the University of St. Andrews. Coming up in 1975, Juan Carlos reclaimed the Spanish throne after 36 years of Franco's dictatorship. We look back on the occasion in Witness History. That's coming up shortly. And looking ahead to later, Jacob faces an unexpected diversion and Kate has important news. That's when we head to Ambridge for the Archers at 11 o'clock.
This winter, cricket's oldest rivalry is reignited.
Bowl him! Bowl him first ball!
England and Australia do battle to compete for the Ashes.
That is extraordinary!
Hear live ball-by-ball commentary on Five Sports Extra and get analysis and reaction of every day's play with the Test Match Special podcast.
The stump's out of the ground!
Test Match Special at the Ashes. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now on BBC Radio 4, time for Witness History with Jane Wilkinson.
We're going back to 1975. General Francisco Franco has just died, ending 36 years of brutal dictatorship. And a royal prince is about to restore his family to the throne of Spain.
Cheering crowds acclaim Spain's new king, Juan Carlos, at ceremonies marking his accession to the throne. Watched by millions of television viewers, King Juan Carlos and Queen Sophie celebrated mass among the congregation. Tens of thousands of Spaniards shouting, "Long live the King," turned out into Madrid's sunlit streets cheering.
Were you absolutely sure that you wanted the job?
You never think of that. I think you are born, you know from what family you are, you know what your duty is. And when duty and patriotism comes along and when it's in the service of your country, I think that any human man who is really honest with himself, I think, would do the same thing if put in my position.
That's Juan Carlos, interviewed for a 1981 TV documentary made just a few years after his accession. The journalist Jack Pizzi is asking the questions, and I've been watching to find out how the new king turned a dictatorship into a democracy. Spain's last monarch, Alfonso XIII, had fled the country with his family in 1931 as support grew for the Republican cause. And after the Spanish Civil War, a new leader emerged, Francisco Franco.
Madrid, the heroic capital of the Spain of yesterday, has surrendered to the forces of General Franco. The gallant people of this shell-torn city have withstood the onslaught of infantry, artillery and bombers. Now government resistance has ended.
It was the start of a 36-year rule of violence and repression. But Franco did not abolish the monarchy. Instead, he brought the young Juan Carlos out of exile and back to Spain. It appeared the general had his eye on a possible successor.
I was born in a foreign country in Italy. Then I went to study in Switzerland. Then I came here only with 9 years old, to my own country. I came like a normal boy, but of course knowing that I was the grandson of King Alfonso XIII, then I knew my background and the background of my family.
Later, Juan Carlos would serve in Spain's army, navy and air force and marry Sofia, a Greek princess. This was the man who Franco believed would one day continue his authoritarian, anti-democratic and deeply conservative regime.
Juan Carlos has been groomed by the Spanish dictator as his successor for several years. He is always at Franco's right-hand side on state occasions.
And in 1969, I became Prince of Spain, named by Franco.
For Franco, now aged 76, has at last decided to name his successor, an heir to the vacant Spanish throne. Franco's choice is Prince Juan Carlos of Bourbon, the 31-year-old grandson of Spain's last king, Alfonso XIII.
Then I realised that someday I could become king.
And in his official oath as heir, Juan Carlos swore loyalty to Franco's national movement.
In all those years when you were here under General Franco, how did you get on with him?
I must tell you very, very well. It was a very familiar way of talking to each other, and of course he was much older than I was, and he used to treat me a little bit like his grandson probably, and in the beginning he didn't pay much attention, but he was very nice with me, and when I married then he was also very nice with the Queen.
But Juan Carlos exposes himself to the accusation that he will be no more than a puppet monarch, with the present authoritarian system of government firmly in control.
Did you discuss the future of Spain together?
Not much, but once I asked him and I said, why don't you tell me a little bit how you manage the things and how you deal with the different problems? And he looked at me and he laughed a little bit and he said, why? I said, well, because I'm interested and I'm willing to learn and I want to know how you do it. And he said to me, it's not interesting for you, because when you will have to do it, you will have to do it completely in another way that I do it. I mean, many people will say it's not true, and I tell you it's true. And this was a real experience for me, which I never paid attention, and probably I only paid attention when I became king.
At 5 o'clock this morning, the Spanish Prime Minister went on television to break the news of Franco's death.
Españoles, Franco ha muerto.
The general will be buried in the Valley of the Fallen. It's a memorial place to all those who died in the civil war that brought him to power.
It was the 20th of November, 1975. 2 days later, the new ruler was sworn in as king.
Que queda proclamado rey de España, don Juan Carlos de Borbón y Borbón. ¡Viva el rey!
¡Viva!
¡Viva España!
But there were early signs that this leader would not, after all, be following in Franco's footsteps.
Since becoming king, one of Juan Carlos's first acts of mercy was to release many prisoners from Spanish jails. Some prisoners waiting sentence of death have also been saved from execution.
In the years that followed, Juan Carlos would appoint a reforming prime minister, encourage the revival of political parties, including the communists, and give amnesty to political prisoners. And then, in 1977, Spain held its first free democratic elections for 41 years. Franco's legacy was being dismantled.
Everyone, or nearly everyone, acknowledges the key role played by the king. To move from a dictatorship to a liberal democracy is certainly a test of nerve. And no one has shown a cooler nerve than the king. And the elections have passed off quietly without incident.
When I became king, I saw that the people and the Spanish people wanted to go towards democracy. And then my own point of view and their point of view coincide, and then I started to move ahead. And I only made, let's say, the first moves. All the rest was done by the governments.
But you admit that you made fundamental moves at the beginning to set things in the direction of democracy.
Well, yes, if you call it like that, yes.
The transition wasn't always peaceful. In some parts of Spain, left poverty-stricken after years under Franco, protest and violence erupted.
There were three bombs today in Spain. One small one was defused near the home of the communist leader, Santiago Carrillo. Two bombs actually exploded outside banks in the north. And they were really the last reminders of the tense atmosphere, including rumours of attempts at a military coup.
I think that when one has to navigate through difficult waters, one has to do it with the heart, knowing very well what one wants, what the aim is, and where one wants to go. And if that one can call it an enterprise, in my case, I think it's very easy, because that enterprise is called Spain.
But what of the oath of loyalty Juan Carlos had sworn to Franco in 1969?
What's happened since then doesn't seem to square with that.
I've been told that a few times, but I tell you, I was very, very sure what I was doing. It was a promise, and I accepted those institutions and those laws of that moment under Franco. And when I became king, the evolution started from those laws, because they were done in such a way that they were provided with some mechanism, legal mechanism, to get more and more towards democratization.
And people now on the far left say that you're too far to the right. People on the far right say that you're too far to the left, that you've betrayed Franco.
Well, as I haven't done it, and as I'm sure about it, then they can say whatever they like.
This is looking ahead a long way, I hope. How would you like to be remembered?
How I would like to be remembered? I'm being a very, very honest, and being myself, I would like to be remembered perhaps as a king who tried to make his duty.
Juan Carlos reigned for 39 years before abdicating in favour of his son Felipe. His reputation had been tarnished by links to a corruption investigation and a controversial elephant hunting trip that he took during Spain's financial crisis. Witness History was produced and presented by me, Jane Wilkinson, using excerpts from the BBC and TVE documentary Juan Carlos, King of Spain.
And for more memorable moments from history told by the people who were there, search for Witness History on BBC Sounds. Paddy O'Connell will be along shortly to present Broadcasting House. Then the writer Sir Salman Rushdie shares the soundtrack of his life with Lauren Laverne on this morning's Desert Island Discs here on BBC Radio 4. Where now the ecologist Mike Dilger celebrates the long-tailed duck in Tweet of the Day.
Amongst admittedly pretty tough competition, the title of Britain's most dapper duck must surely go to the long-tailed. This superb and surprisingly sonorous sea duck is solely a winter visitor to Britain and graces a few special sites like Scotland's Moray Coast, where you can delight in their antics between November and April. In Britain, the males split their day between diving down to the seabed for shellfish and flirting with the dusky and somewhat dowdy females. Appearing mostly white, with dusky cheek patches and black wings, it is, however, the male's trademark pair of long black tail plumes that always catches your eye. I was lucky enough to spend an entire summer filming a charismatic breeding pair of Jure falcons in Canada's high Arctic. But, if I'm entirely honest, it was the long-tailed ducks nesting up on the high tundra with their dashing good looks and yodeling calls that somewhat stole the show.